On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! If it's Monday, then it must be Peoria. No, 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 no. Wait, Bob, what the? Wait, that's from the old summer stock days. No, if it's Monday, there must be Morans. Oh, yes, brethren and sistren. Oh, wait, that's Wednesday. It's Moran Monday on the horn. Whoop! And we have several contestants for you this evening. Oh, don't we, don't we, don't we. I've had this one on my list for, several days now, ever since the news broke. Maybe the news broke Friday, I'm not sure. But, you know, you can qualify for Moran Monday anytime, not you, you know what I mean. A right-wing Republican, more likely than not, evangelical, fundamentalist, authoritarian, proto-fascist, whatever, can qualify for Moran Monday anytime between the end of show Friday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and showtime Monday, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That is almost a complete Friday, Saturday, Saturday, Sunday, Sunday. That is almost a complete 72-hour window. It is, in fact, and the pervs among you will appreciate this, a 69-hour window in which the Morans can always, always, always have a shot at making the Moran Monday list here on the horn. And they certainly did work at it this weekend, I have to tell you. I put together the show post to send off to News Ninja Susan because she knows how to drive the blog and I don't. I drive it into buggies and parking lots and stuff when I try to drive the blog. But News Ninja Susan knows how. And I'm going to learn soon. I keep promising myself. I really, really am. I keep trying, but I don't do it enough to make it sort of burn itself into my tiny little mind. But anyway, no, I just sent the show post off to News Ninja Susan, and I put what I thought were some solid nominees in. You're welcome to nominate on your own if you so desire. But here, let me just lay out, and by the way, something else, something serious that we have for this evening. We will be joined by American World Service Corps promoter and the peace activist, I think, is a safe word to use, Dwayne Hunn, here in about, 27 minutes or so, for a little talk about Haiti and how something like an American World Service Corps could have made the response to Haiti a great deal more fluid and a great deal more effective. So that's coming up in about 27 minutes. But before we get there, we do have our Moran nominees. One of them, I have to tell you, is visual. So, on my status update over at Facebook, you can find the link. It is a YouTube link that was provided to me by, Garrett, whom you've heard on the program on a number of occasions, who comes from out Vegas way and is a dedicated sport fan. As well as he's a polymath of many subjects, like so many folks here on the horn. I'm blessed with smart people and not ditto heads, and believe me, that's what's made this doable for so long. But anyway, I've got this. I posted and I included the link also in the show post to Susan, so it'll be there on the horn website as well, headonradionetwork.com. Okay? What you'll see, well, let me see if I can combine these two. First of all, my first nominee, because it happened, like I said, very near the beginning of the end of the Friday night show in the Moran window opening, was the announcement, and of course, the Super Bowl's being carried by Fox, so why am I not surprised that they've decided to sell ads to the Focus on the Family, who are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, this is a tax-exempt Christian organization that is spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to run ads about their culture of life during the Super Bowl. So far, so good? Yeah. Or so far, so obnoxious. So far, so revolting. You know the whole scam with Super Bowl advertising. It's the Christmas of the advertising world. There are people who have no interest in football whatsoever who will watch the Super Bowl to see the fun new ads. That is the depth to which our culture has sunk, in which some of our best, I don't know, multimedia art is made in the form of Budweiser commercials that run during the Super Bowl. And as a devotee of the Budweiser lizards, I want to include myself among the guilty in that, because I do the same thing. Some are good, some are bad, and some are pure genius. Ah, Louis, you're begging for a pink slip. That is not French! Yeah, look, it sticks. See? That's the cultural failings of our country. We're into our commercials now. Or the triumph of marketing. I don't know. You pick. But anyway, for the first time that I am aware of, that I can recall, the Super Bowl will feature an issue advocacy ad. Now, I remember when there was, back during the bad old tormented long eight tortured filthy years of the George W. Bush administration, somebody wanted to run, I don't know, an anti-war ad or something like that. And, the Super Bowl stepped in, the network stepped in and said, No, I don't think so. I don't think so, Melissa. You can't run one of those liberal ads during the Super Bowl. Can't do it. Well, that's okay. Fox bought the contract to run the Super Bowl, and they're going to run all kinds of fundy BS, including an ad from the American Family Association that they say will celebrate a culture of life. Right. And who's going to be in this ad about the culture of life? Why, little Timmy Jebo. Yes, 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 Mr. I Black Jesus himself is going to be in the Focus on the Family ad in the Super Bowl. So let me back up. The Super Bowl will feature two of four teams now established, either the Minnesota Vikings or the New Orleans Saints on one side, or the New York Jets or the Indianapolis Colts on the other. Me, as of next Sunday, I'm a Jets fan, and I'm a New Orleans fan. Because, you know what? For a Super Bowl that's going to feature a fundy commercial about the culture of life and being able to control women's insides, you know, James Dobson is in his dotage and his dotterage, and he's starting a new radio show with millions upon millions of dollars, even though they've laid off thousands and thousands of people that Focus on the Family. That's okay. He misses the microphone. He misses the crazy. Pat Robertson's out there having all the fun with the voodoo comments and whatnot. But they're gonna run this ad in the Super Bowl that I'm hoping will feature what, for all intents and purposes, considering the way that fundamentalists feel about these two places, the Sodom Saints versus the Gomorrah Jets. Because there are no two other cities in the United States, with the possible exception of San Francisco, that fundies hate more than them two denizens of sin, New York City and New Orleans. Oh, they're just covered up with the homosexuals and And all of them drag queens that make our good pastors lose their minds and have sex in alleyways with them. Oh, it's terrible, terrible. So I'm rooting for a New Orleans, New York, J-E-T-S, Jets, Super Bowl. And, of course, there was a fellow in the stands in San Diego just yesterday who was really, really tickled to see that his Jets were beating up those fundamentalist San Diego Chargers. And he was standing up, and he was having a righteous good time. J-E-T-S, Jets, Jets, Jets. You know, it's one of the oldest known cheers in the NFL. Otherwise known as the No Fun League. And if you watch this video that's up either at headonradionetwork.com or on my status update on Facebook, you will see a bunch of blue-suited, puzzle-gutted thugs with guns come and knock the guy to the ground, pick him up, and carry him physically away with not even so much as a you're under arrest for. Astonishing. And then a guy behind him questions him and says, what the hell did he do? You want to talk to me? You can come away with me, citizen. And so they carry him off, too, for daring to question authority. I ran the video past cultural consultant David from Tennessee, asking him if he was familiar with this, if he'd seen it, and he said, no, I hadn't seen it. But he said various NFL sites are repressive in their desire to have a well-behaved crowd. Remember, in building his Jerry Jones of the Dallas Cowboys built a stadium with the largest jail of any NFL facility in it. No kidding. So, yeah, David's spot on. He says, obviously, the San Diego folks want a sedate crowd. If you're out of your seat or standing for more than like 30 seconds, it will get you a visit from the Buzzcut Roid Squad. All but one or two NFL stadia have a texting program. You text a security number, give section and row, not even seat number, tell them you're not enjoying the game, and here come the pigs. Titans Stadium is like that. Stand and cheer, yell for 3 or 4 minutes, and out you go. Nowadays, if anyone says anything even mildly disruptive in a crowd setting, and you're going down, cops are quick to take down anybody even vaguely resembling an instigator. Hence, the guy that didn't go all sheeple for the lead pig, he went out too. You want to talk to me? Let's go outside. He was too verbal with Mr. Big Blue. All that, David observes, and it's San Diego. Very Republican, very military, Daryl Issa, Duke Cunningham country. Any further questions? So there's that. Okay, now, backing up. During the Super Bowl, an ad will run on behalf of the American Family Association. God bless you. Send us some more money so that we can do some more hate-filled ads about our culture of life. And here's the fun part. They didn't even have to pay him to do it. He done it for Jeebus. Tim Tebow. God's own quarterback, whom God somehow couldn't quite get to the national championship game because, really, God didn't have the running game this year. Well, he did, but he was Mark Ingram, and he played for Alabama because Mark Ingram was doing a lot of finger-pointing toward it. If God hadn't been so damn busy with these quarterbacks and these running backs and the little, the wideouts and the, hey, Jesus, look at me. Because Jesus is looking. Hey, wait, I took my eye off Haiti for a minute. You bastards! You know how it works. So there are some several hundreds of thousands of dollars being expended by the American Family Association to run an ad encouraging women to give men control of their uteri. Yeah, I know. And Tim Tebow's going to be the spokesman for that. Tim Tebow, who wore eye black, that said, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Except, apparently, get off his white ass and fly his ass down to Haiti and start digging through some rubble like Jesus would do. Remember, Jesus H. Tebow's parents are missionaries. You know, I mean, they're in, like, direct communication with Jeebus. God. And they didn't say, Timmy, you know where it says in Matthew, if you've done it unto the least of these, you've done it also unto me. You know where it says that? We read that to you a lot, didn't we, Timmy?
Why, yes, Mommy. Yes, Daddy.
Well, son, now it's time to live it. Hell has yawned open in Haiti, son. And evangelical Christians need to see a fine, upstanding white boy going down there and digging through the rubble to save some people. They need to see that, son. Now, you're all locked up for money. You won the Heisman Trophy. You've graduated. People cried over your graduation. They have posted your 19 words at the University of Florida. Son, you're a legend. But now is where all of that teaching about Jesus. Well, son, this is where the rubber meets the road. We've got you a flight through Samaritan's Purse. They'll fly you on the same jet, son, that carried the American Esther, Sarah Palin, on her bus tour throughout the United States. And they'll fly you down to Port-au-Prince, son. You can just be there a weekend. But it'll mean so much to the evangelical fundamentalist white Christian community to see you working like that for people who don't deserve your love or your concern. It'll show them what the message of Christ Jesus really is, son. For if you've done it unto the least of these, son, you've done it also unto him. And we can't be neglecting Jesus. Go to Haiti, Tim. Son. Go to Haiti. There's only one problem. If a speech like that had been given, I would be in tears, and I would think twice about the meaning of fundamental evangelical Christianity. I really would. But it didn't happen. No. No, those hundreds of thousands of dollars are going to be paid to Fox Broadcasting, Fox Sports. And they are going to be used in the service of Mammon. And if there was 10 cents worth of morality, and I don't see anybody talking about this yet. I guess it's one of those things that only happens on the Horn and then maybe somewhere else. But if there was 10 cents of worth, if there was 10 cents worth of morality inside the leathery, withered, old, vile, dark, poisonous, half-fermented, rotten thing that is the soul of James Dobson, all of that money would be going to Haiti, not into the pockets of some Fox Sports marketing ass, and little Timmy Tebow would be in Haiti right now, living the life that his master, his teacher, his personal Lord and Savior commands. But Timmy won't, and Timmy can't, because Timmy's a moron, right? Right. Of course, I suppose there is one good thing about the laugh ad that will run during the Super Bowl, thanks to thousands and thousands of hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of $1 million of little old lady donations to focus on the family. There's one good thing about it. Little Timmy Tebow will appear during a Super Bowl, because that is the only time little Timmy Tebow will appear in a Super Bowl. That kid ain't right. Nope. Like the guy David heard talking one day. The only Tim Tebow sightings are going to be on a cinnamon roll down at the Cinnabon. Timmy ain't playing no NFL quarterback. But those are two of our morons. I got two more. Don't worry. Those are two of our morons. And what we'll do is we'll go to the phones real quick before our conversation with Dwayne Hunn. And that's coming in about 10 minutes. And just see what's on you guys' mind. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, this is Edward in Dallas.
Well, hey, Edward, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good for an old fart. Well, anyway, you've been talking about Dick Armey, and it reminded me of a comedian and a commentator a number of years ago when Dick Armey first broke onto the scene. And I can't tell you his name because I don't want to get sued. But anyway, he said, Dick Armey. Dick Armey. That sounds like the chorus line in a gay nightclub.
He'll be here all week. Try the veal. Oh, that's a good one.
That's one of my favorite things from the years past.
Well, you know, he is one of you're a Texan, and he's one of your own.
Oh, I know, and I have a friend who took economics from him at North Texas, and she says, "Now you know why I don't know anything about economics."
Well, without being cruel to the great lady from Alabama, taking economics from Dick Armey is about like taking speech lessons from Helen Keller, isn't it?
Ain't it the truth? Well, you take care, and I know you've got other callers wanting to call in. Oh, by the way.
Yes.
When, who do I send something if I want to make a donation? I can't make much because I'm old.
Well, bless your heart, you can do one of two things. There is a PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com.
Uh-huh.
Or there is a regular mail address there as well.
Okay.
There's a tab that says contribute, and both are available right there.
Oh, very good.
And thank you very kindly for asking, and it's great talking to you. I hope, don't be a stranger.
Great talking to you. I listen to you all the time. I think you're a hoot.
Well, thank you. I'm glad, then we're doing our job.
Yes.
All right. Take care, Edward.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Whoa. New caller. Yay. Cool. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey,
Susan, what's up?
Well, how's your tea supply?
No better.
Well, it'll come.
No, I used my last bag. See, I held out, and I used my last bag of ginger peach decaf Friday night just to make the show special. Because I was just sure that by today. But, no.
It will come.
Apparently they have it hand-picked when it's ordered.
More or less, yeah. Got a candidate for you, and you are just going to love this. I'm looking at a Guardian article. Cruise ships still find a Haitian birth.
What?
60 miles from Haiti's devastated earthquake zone, luxury liners dock at private beaches for passengers enjoy jet ski rides, parasailing, and rum cocktails delivered to their hammocks. They're protected by armed guards.
Sweet Jesus.
These ships carry 2,000 and 3,000 people apiece. They could provide temporary housing. No, they're not even showing up with anything more than token amounts of supplies for people. No, they're just showing up to do their parties. In fact, it's so bad that about half of the passengers, even the passengers that are disgusted,
Well, I was going to ask, what about, I mean, the passengers, surely to God, they're not just, oh, look, it's Haiti.
Yeah, about half of the passengers are literally disgusted, and they're refusing to disembark.
Well, thank heaven for that.
This is the Royal Caribbean International cruise line.
And something that was pointed out to me is that, sadly, when we had the cruise ship discussion, I guess last week, Susan, it was pointed out to me that, of course, most cruise lines are no longer operated by American companies. So there is something next to nothing that can be done about their behavior. But Jesus, what a slap in the face! I wouldn't get on a Royal Caribbean boat to save my soul. Because
the thing is,
when you've done that, you've got some bad seafaring karma floating around your boat after that.
Yeah, according to this, it says this is listed as a Florida cruise company. So this may be one of the few.
Wow, could you investigate a little bit more on that, please?
I'm gonna work on that. I just can't believe this. This is just appalling.
Did they give the name of the location where they dock?
Let's see. They gave the name of the ship. It's 4,370 berth Independence of the Seas is the name of the ship. And there's a second one with 3,100 berth.
Dear Lord.
Navigator of the Seas is due also to dock.
You know, that's a couple of Poseidon adventures waiting to happen, at least from a karmic standpoint. Ooh.
Oh, listen to this. The Florida Cruise Company leases a picturesque wooded peninsula and its five pristine beaches from the government for passengers to, quote, cut loose, unquote, with water sports, barbecues, and shopping for trinkets at a craft market before returning to board before dusk. Safety is guaranteed by armed guards at the gate. They're sitting there eating barbecue, and these people don't have food. They don't have water.
No.
My God!
But see, the people who sign on for the cruises, though, they're locked in. There ain't no refunds. There ain't no rebates.
Oh, yeah, I understand that. Let's see. Yeah, the passengers are, about half the passengers are just appalling.
Good. Hey, Susan, I got to run because we're running up against this evening's conversation, but thank you for that, and shoot me the linky, would you?
Yeah, I'm going to also post it on the main site.
Do please.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Susan. All right. Bye-bye. News Ninja Susan calling from Oregon. We'll squeeze one more phone call in before we go to Dwayne Hunn. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
Is it Senator King or Representative King?
Well, he's a state senator right now.
Okay.
Oh, wait. Well, I'm sorry. No, Representative Peter King? Are you talking about that screwball from Iowa?
Yeah, one of them. My dad would call him a sling nasty.
A sling nasty?
Uh-huh.
There go. Well, there's one for the book.
I had forgot about my daddy. Anyway, he said that we shouldn't let the Haitians over here stay, that we should send them back to Haiti so they could dig through the rubble.
I saw that.
I say, I want to know where his record is that he dug through the alligators in New Orleans.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yep.
Because it doesn't exist.
I missed the very first part, but Dick Armey is one of my least favorite sling nasties of all time.
Sling nasty.
Yeah, that just come to me a while ago. I thought, my daddy used to say that. Anyway. You have a good evening.
Well, I will, and thank you, Juanita, and maybe
here. Who are you going to have on?
Dwayne Hunn will be on in just a minute or two.
Dwayne
Hunn from the American World Service Corps.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Okay.
And maybe we'll talk a little more here on Moran Monday a little bit later.
Well, okay. That's basically what I had to say.
Well, just don't let me forget Sling Nasty.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Take care, Juanita.
Okay.
Bye, bye now. And let's, I'm suspecting that this is, in fact, Dwayne Hunn. Is that you, Dwayne?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is, Bob.
Hot dog. Thank you for joining in this evening, Dwayne Hunn. How best should we describe you as the originator of the idea of the American World Service Corps?
Well, I'm the originator of the idea, but we're running it through People's Lobby, People's Lobby Inc., which is a long history of doing, writing laws through the initiative process. As maybe your listeners know, 24 states have the initiative process, and we in People's Lobby in California kind of got it back to its grassroots origination by running two clean environment initiatives and then a political reform act, which the politicians in California did not want to enact because we drastically limited what lobbyists could spend on politicians, and we threw politicians in jail. In fact, they just fined about 33 of them through the Fair Political Practices Commission, which our initiative set up. And if people aren't familiar with the initiative, it's like you and I could sit down and write a law, and if we can go out in those 24 initiative states and get 5% of the people who voted for governor in the last election to sign this petition that says we want to see this law that Bob and Dwayne wrote on the ballot so we can vote on it, and if then 50% of the people plus one voted yes on it, then it would skip the state legislature and skip the governor and become law, because the initiative process is based on the premise that the real power lies with the people, and they can write their own law just as well or better and be more powerful than a legislature can or that a governor can push through. So that's, though I originated the World Service Corps bill, I've had some input as I wrote the law. People would say, well, why don't you, you know, add this to it? And I'd say, you know, that's a good idea. So I go back and I doctor up the law a little bit, just like they would do if Congress would introduce it. It would go to all these subcommittees and people would add this or take out that. So, you know, as individual citizens, we can do that. And what I'm trying to do is outside of People's Lobby's initiative parameter, because we do not have a national initiative, although People's Lobby had hearings for 3 days back in the late 70s in Washington, D.C., to see if the government would allow us to establish a national initiative process. And those hearings, we had good hearings, but the government doesn't want to share that power very much. And some people since then have come to People's Lobby, like Senator Gravel, who I don't trust anymore since he borrowed a bunch of money from us and hasn't paid it back.
Oops.
But he and others are trying to push the national initiative, which we also birthed. I mean, the founders of the organization, which are Ed and Joyce Kupel. They were my mentors, and unfortunately they're in heaven, and if they were around here now, we'd be a lot further along on all these things. So that was a long-winded answer. Did that answer your question?
Yes, indeed. I think that gets us sort of placed in this space where we can go forward. In other words, the American World Service Corps was born out of the notion, background notion, that people can be responsible for the good ideas that turn into our own governance.
Well, yeah, it's based on two premises. One, it's based on not just the People's Lobby experience, where we got used to saying, hey, we can write laws as individuals. We had a steering board of 40, and we sat around and said, when we got beat on the clean environment initiatives, two of them, those initiatives we tried, and you're really into this out in West Virginia, I know, with the mountaintop removal I hear on the radio quite often. We tried to ban the use of DDT in the state of California. We tried to lower the lead content of gasoline in our bill, in the law that we wrote, to put a moratorium on the construction of nuclear power plants until they can be proven safe, and to lower the sulfide oxide emissions of diesel fuel. Now, we started out way ahead in the polls, but we had no money. We had 40 people that really worked out in the field throughout California. We gave them a good fight, but they bought off all these TV ads, ran all these phony TV ads, and hoodwinked the people, as, you know, as goes on today.
Right.
And we came back as disheartened 20-year-olds, but Ed and Joyce said, well, what are you disheartened about? You gave them a good fight, and we're going to beat them next time. And we said, well, yeah, but we're never going to beat the money. They're always going to outspend us on TV, and we don't have that money. Our biggest donor was Paul Newman at $5,000 or $500. I forget which, 500, I think. And so, you know, what he then said, well, if you want to get rid of money in politics, write the law. Because he would say the mantra of People's Lobby was, this country runs on laws. If you want to change the country, write its laws. So that then got us to write the Political Reform Act, which limited what lobbyists could give to politicians to basically a Big Mac, a milkshake, and fries. That's all they could spend on a politician each month. And that some of this has been weakened by the state Supreme Court. So there's that premise that if you want to change the country, write your own laws. That undermines the American World Service Corps, underpins it. And the other underpinning came from my experience in the Peace Corps. You know, when you know, the stuff you're talking about Haiti and the people not having any water, when you're a Peace Corps volunteer in the slums of Bombay, and you realize that the slum that you live in only gets water for 3 or 4 hours a day at the most, and they got to put it in buckets and carry it up 3 or 4 floors and pour it in a 55-gallon bucket, and you realize that people have to urinate and defecate in little ditches they build outside their hutments. Basically, you know, that's going on in Haiti today. Well, that experience said to me, Jesus, you know, the world is really in bad shape. And this gets to the thing you were talking about earlier in your show about Super Bowl and the ads that Fox News will be running on the Super Bowl. And, you know, that's one of our problems. We got a country that's become, it lays its eyes and its biceps on a TV and watches the Super Bowl and thinks it's a He-Man country. And when you go over the world, out in the world, and you see how poorly some people have to live and how we are really just small compared to the needs of the world, then you say, well, why don't we get more Americans involved in fixing those problems? And in fixing those problems, you're also going to raise the public policy IQ, like the woman before you calling in talking about these people on cruise lines. Well, 15% of Americans take out passports. When you subtract those who have military passports and corporate passports, the guys who ride around in jets and only talk to people in Abu Dhabi towers, and you subtract then the people who go on cruise lines with their passports, you get a very small number of Americans who go out there and taste the world and come back with a public policy IQ that is increased. And now my public policy IQ might be a typical Ohio football fan watching football every Sunday and games, but I got this opportunity to do the Peace Corps because I was inspired by the words of John Kennedy.
Right.
And I said, well, I'm going to go out there. Now, I think I have a little bit higher public policy IQ than somebody who's watched the 27 Super Bowls in a row, and I've only seen a couple with Joe Montana and Steve Young. So.
Oh, okay. You've just given away your bias. but no, you are absolutely correct, Dwayne. And the question, and I raised it on the program early on as news of the Haiti disaster became more apparent, is that, you know, this is precisely the sort of thing that you envisioned the American World Service Corps doing. And that if something like this was combined with, say, you know, that much derided Department of Peace that Dennis Kucinich envisioned, that we had on standby a constant cadre of people ready to go and deal with disasters, in a, you know, from a centralized standpoint, doctors, nurses, infrastructure people, yes, security people who could, you know, rapid response, immediate response. You know, we've had problems, we've had airport problems in Port-au-Prince. Okay, well, why aren't there any seaplanes? You know, dream big, think big if you're going to make something like this happen. Because the one thing you can count on is that in the scene of any disaster, infrastructure will be overburdened, and you have to know how to deal with that. And something like what you have envisioned could do that.
Right, but what we envision, you know, goes much further, and I want to touch on Kucinich and standby stuff, too. And if people are interested in this, if they're in front of their computers, just type in www.worldservicecorps.us, and you can go to our website. And if you like the idea, at least sign the petition. One of the links up above says sign the petition. But I'd like you to do more than that, obviously. We'd like you to contact our top people to contact are Senator Jim Webb, Congressman Joe Sestak, and Senators Boxer and Feinstein, but anybody whose district you're in, your congressperson. But when you said, you know, let's have this Army on standby, sure, that's part of this. But, you know, the bigger a bigger part is, and maybe I should explain, too, to the people who don't know what it is. We have written a congressional legislation, which is there at the website, worldservicecorps.us, and it says that over the next 7 years, if this legislation passed, it would ramp up, increase by 150,000 Americans per year, until by the seventh year you had 1 million Americans voluntarily serving in this peaceful, productive Army, and we're going to compensate them for doing a year or two of service. But we're not going to build a new army. We're going to use the platoons that are already out there in the field. We're just going to send peaceful soldiers to them, soldiers in sandals rather than in armored gear. And those platoons that already exist, and more can be added to this list, include the Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, Habitat, Doctors Without Borders, Head Start, the Red Cross, International Rescue Committee, Oxfam, Mercy Corps, and State Conservation Corps. And again, you can add more to that list. And most of those you've heard talked about at the Haiti disaster. We're saying, yeah, they can develop their standby army, but they're going to have 1 million Americans every year for the next 20 years. After we get to 1 million, the legislation says you do not sunset this for 20 years. So in 27 years, you'd roughly have 21 million Americans who would have voluntarily served either at home, it's their choice, you know, with AmeriCorps or Head Start, or abroad with Peace Corps or Habitat or Mercy Corps. So they get their choice. But we have a 21st century Army that has to start dealing with the reality that we have 7 billion people in the world, 2 to 3 billion of them live on a couple bucks a day. Many of those, some of those were in Haiti, and we don't have an Army to deal with that, and we keep sending our Marines out. We send them out to do our fighting, then we send them down to Haiti to unload stuff, and we're privatized the rest of everything we do.
And let me just interject there something for a moment, Dwayne. I have profound respect for the noble work that the military does in these disasters, and the noble work that for instance, our National Guards do when they're not over slaughtering Iraq in the midst of disasters, tornadoes, floods, hurricanes, things like that. I admire it, and frankly, it is noble. It's the noblest work that they do. But when you take someone who has been trained to kill, at a word, to kill, and then expect them to manifest compassion, aren't you putting the very military process at odds with itself?
Probably.
And what I'm saying is, take the people who are trained to kill, and let them do their job. But we need, and God knows the employment numbers in the U.S. sort of indicate this, we also need an outlet for our compassion. We need an outlet for our caring. We need an outlet for what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature. And that, yeah. And that I think, is a perfect fit with what you're describing.
It's close, but, you know, I want to tell you a little story. Maybe I mentioned this last time on your show. I don't remember, but there is a kid named Matt. I work with Nadia McCafferty, a Gold Star mom who lost her National Guard son in Iraq when he was murdered by the very Iraqi troops that he was training when President Bush was saying, we're going to train them up so we can step down. They turned their guns on him and his lieutenant. After a sniper started it, the backup soldiers that he had trained turned their machine guns on and killed Nadia's son. Well, Nadia had, you know, she had a bunch of news crews down there. One time she had Dan Rather down at her house, and she had me come down, and there was this Matt down there another time. Now, this Matt was a kid who went into the military, early 20s, did his three years of service in Iraq most of those years, and he was on camera the first time I met him talking about how he had been in Iraq in a firefight, and he was in the dirt, and they were having a firefight, and he says, you know what, I reached down and I kept looking at the dirt and how rich it was while he's using his gun every now and then. And he said, and I looked off in the corner, and he says, and there was this farmer, and he says, it happened all the time. The farmers would just keep farming while we're in a firefight. And it was something strange about his comments. This kid did his 4 years, left the military. You know what the kid did? He joined the Peace Corps and went to Nigeria, I'm forgetting which. And he said when he walked into the village, it was the first white guy they had ever seen. He was supposed to train them on agricultural stuff. He had a love for agriculture, but he said they knew a hell of a lot more than I did.
Sure.
About how to grow the stuff that they were supposed to grow. And he said, and they didn't trust me for a while, but after a while, he stayed there a year, and then after 1 year, he gets a letter from Uncle Sam reminding him that the fine print in his contract with the military said, until the duration of the war. So they said, you got to come back. We got to send you out there again. And he said, what? He says, I did my 4 years. And his words to me were, look, he said, I know this. He says, I know in Iraq I did bad things. I don't want to do them again. He says, I know in the Peace Corps I may not have done much, but I didn't do anything bad. And he didn't want to go. Now, Michael O'Gorman, who runs this Farms Not Arms organization out here in California, helped him fight that. And he says, I can't assure you that you won't get thrown in the brig. And the kid said, I want to fight it anyway. You know what that kid is today? He's a farmer out here in northern Berkeley. So even though I think, you know, we train our people to be killers, there's still this basic instinct, if we don't give them too much PTSD, that says, you know, I'd rather be, you know, giving out food or building a well or doing something like that.
Oh, without a doubt. What I was suggesting is that what we have is a military that is stretched so thin right now it is nigh unto the breaking point.
Right.
Many of whom are already damaged. And frankly, you know, unless you're one of these multimillionaire parachute journalists who jumps in there and says, oh, look at the bodies, and then flies away home to a dinner of, you know, hummingbird tongues, you're going to be rather profoundly impacted by this stuff. And so we take people who are already horrified and traumatized by war and say, look, this isn't even war, and it's in many ways worse. Congratulations. Welcome to your PTSD claim.
Yeah, and there's so many of them that are having that. It's like, have you seen Avatar?
Yes, I have. In fact, we could probably do an entire show on Avatar.
And I think it ties in with this. I mean, when I see it, maybe I see everything from this perspective. But, you know, here's the soldier who can't afford health insurance, doesn't have legs, and he's, you know, the key humanoid avatar. And here's the corporations wanting to go in and mine the stone or take the oil from the Middle East, whatever analogy you want to use. And here's the...
Yeah, we're watching it around here, Dwayne. We're watching the Navi as more or less blue hillbillies.
Okay. Yeah, you have your perspective.
You know, take kill the blue hillbillies and take the black energy rock.
Yeah, right. And I say to myself, you know, if there were more people that did this kind of service, you wouldn't get into that hellhole. If we have done this since Kennedy was president, Kennedy wanted the Peace Corps to be a million strong within 10 years. If we had 30 or 40 million returned Peace Corps volunteers, and I probably asked you, do you know how many, you want to take, guess how many returned Peace Corps volunteers we have back in this country?
Alums-wise, I'm guessing probably not even 150,000.
Right around there, that have done the full 2 years. And here, if you had 20 or 30 million like Kennedy wanted by now, your public policy IQ would have never let you go into Iraq and spend $3 trillion and blow your budget and your economy.
Well, I think you just explained why there aren't.
Yeah, that may be. And when you cut down to Haiti today, Haiti. You know how many Peace Corps volunteers have served in Haiti since 1961 and Kennedy started the Peace Corps?
Oh, 15,000.
15,000?
Yeah.
You're right at the first part. 15.
Stop it.
1-5 in one of the countries in the hemisphere.
15? We have sent 15 Peace Corps volunteers to Haiti?
15. Now, you could say, well, there was a dictator down there for a while, but that's all the more reason you want to get your Peace Corps volunteers in. Next door in Dominican Republic, which has the prettier beaches and the richer soil, they've had 4,000 Peace Corps volunteers. In the Eastern Caribbean islands, the islands that are spectered a little bit to the south and the east, they've had 3,600, a little over 3,600. And in Jamaica to the west, they've had over 3,600. Jamaica?
15.
And you wonder,
you know,
why
that may be the Dwayne, let me just stop you for a minute. That may be the news flash out of this conversation.
Well, I hope you put it up on your website later, because I'm trying to get it out there.
15?
1-5. It was in 82 and 83. There were a couple in 90 and 92. There was 4-5. And, you know, that it totals up to 15. Well, I have it right here. 82 to 87, 5. 90 to 91, 1. That must have been a Superman Peace Corps volunteer. 96 to 2005, 9. 15 total.
Jesus.
So, you know, and again, it gets back to, there are places like this all around the world that are poor. I mean, you go to, I have my buddy, you know, my buddy and I both served in the Peace Corps. He was in a rural community construction thing. I trained with them for a while. So, you know, if you would have had a bunch of Peace Corps volunteers from my rural community construction group go to Haiti over the last bunch of years, there would have been rebar in those buildings, because I was with architects and engineers and general contractors when we retrained. You knew the basics. Those buildings would have been better prepared. You can't ever prepare for an earthquake, but better prepared. Not as many would be dead or killed. And you would have had wells. You would have had pure water. They're fighting over water trucks. You know, you would have had all those things. And we didn't. We didn't have a standing American World Service Corps. We didn't have, like, Habitat now wants to go down there, and I hope I can do another Habitat with them if I can just get this piece of legislation further along, that they're going to try and go down there and build homes. Well, that gets back to your point. Why don't we have this standing army that says, hey, we know what you need. In 3 weeks, we're sending 20,000 Americans. We're going to work alongside of you. We're going to build 20,000 homes. This is Jimmy Carter squared. We don't have that, and yet that would help Obama in the world. And if you want to stop the spread of terrorism, then that's the damn thing you ought to be doing. You ought to be announcing that instead of...
Right, because when the guy says, you know, hey, I've got a dynamite belt, why don't you go kill some Americans? And the guy looks and says, you see my house? They built my house. I don't hate them.
That's right. And that's that. When you build a house with Habitat like we did in Sri Lanka, we went into a Muslim village and we built a house for the only Christian family in that Muslim village. And I don't know if I'm repeating myself, but a bunch of these healthy Muslim kids stood and watched us for 2 or 3 days of sweat and work. You know, we're working with the family and with the foreman, who's a Sri Lankan. And this one kid is just standing there flexing his biceps. And after the second or third day, he came up and started talking to us. And when he stepped forward, his 4 or 5 guys all stepped forward, all young 20-ish-year-old kids. This kid, Robbie, was the kickboxing champion of Sri Lanka, and he was just checking us out. He wanted to know if we Americans were really, you know, on the up and up. And if that happened in that village, you know, somebody came in and said, let's blow up some Americans, they would just say what you said. See that house and that house over there? Those built by Americans. Get out of here. We're going to kick your butt. But we don't do that kind of visionary, strategic, Sun Tzu kind of tactics in trying to defeat the enemy.
No, we don't. And that's a great reference to Sun Tzu. I was just given a link by one of our news ninjas who pointed out, they sent me to the history of the Peace Corps in Haiti. And it's astonishing because it says, the Peace Corps volunteers have worked in Haiti over 3 periods, 82 to 87, 90 to 91, and 96 to the present. 82 to 87 volunteers worked in, and by the way, you've already given us the numbers, right? How many were there in 82 to 87?
five.
Yeah. They worked in agroforestry, fisheries, and vocational training. And then this little sentence, political unrest and a congressional resolution led to a suspension of the program. In other words, Congress decided to punish poor people by taking away the people who were helping the poor people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not. And again, you know, we've had some poor leadership at the top, and again, a lot has happened to the Peace Corps. When the Peace Corps started, Shriver pushed Kennedy, and Kennedy agreed with it, that the Peace Corps would be totally separate from aid and these other agencies. They'd be an independent entity. They could do their own thing. And that's, over the years, been defiled. And we now have it under the Corporation for National Service or something. You know, and that, they put that term in there during, I think, the Reagan or Nixon era, I forget. But all of that made some of us who really felt we had the heart and soul of the Peace Corps in mind, saying, no, you should leave it alone. Let them go in there, because even when the government isn't liked, even when the country you're going to doesn't like the American government, they like American Peace Corps volunteers. And you get that story after story after story. They can be at war with America, or they can have rebels in the jungle, and they'll protect the Peace Corps volunteers. So, and it's so simple, but you have such simpletons making policy, and then you also have so many who don't have a vision of how you ought to approach the future. We can't keep fighting these kind of military wars the way the Colonel in Avatar wants to fight them, because we're broke now. You know, I kept wondering why it wasn't happening 10 or 15 years ago. And when it finally happens, you say, well, of course, you spent all this money on guns. And if you go into Haiti, I did a talk show with one of your partner friends there, Jeff Farias. And Naomi Klein made this statement about, you know, that she's worried that multinationals are going to take over in Haiti. That ought to be a worry. If the contracts go out, and since KNBR and Halliburton have kind of killed all the littler competitors, it may end up that Halliburton, KNBR, and Bechtel and those big corporations get a bunch of money to rebuild Haiti, where you got to have some big money to do big things, but you really ought to flood that country with Peace Corps volunteers and do it from the grassroots up. Let those people first learn how to grow some cash crops or subsistence crops, and then cash crops, and let them have that peaceful, idyllic life that they want without having Big Max and Halliburton running the show.
Yes. And moreover, you know, what also comes out of that is the fact that you've probably got to work on a deeper level than that, because there is probably no spot in the Western Hemisphere where, for instance, the soil is more exhausted than it is in Haiti.
Yes.
So, you know, you've got to go, you know, there's real elemental stuff that needs to happen. Composting, for God's sakes. The permaculture issues, the frame farming, whatever it is that you have to do, you've got to make that land support those people.
You got to regrow a bunch of trees too to start. I mean, you could have giant.
Yeah, and oddly enough, I was going to tell you. You mentioned Susan's call before our conversation started. There's a photograph, and here I go talking about a photograph on the radio. You know, Lee. There's a photograph of one of these Royal Caribbean cruise ships docked in this, you know, this beautiful little harbor. It's you know, just looks like paradise, because that little chunk of it, for corporate purposes, is. And it's not deforested. It's rolling green hills and a rocky cove, and it's beautiful. But that's because it has been paid, that money has been paid to maintain it as such, so that the little tourists won't feel bad about it and won't realize that they are docked in the poorest single nation in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah.
Reforestation, decorporatization, and I think Naomi Klein has a legitimate concern. It can't be turned into a playground for the corporate elite, because they never, ever, ever act in the best interest of any human beings outside the sphere of, at best, their board of directors, their officer corps, and their executive management. They just don't,
yes,
because it's not in the nature of a corporation to do that.
My buddy's son went into the Peace Corps, and he went next door to the Dominican Republic. And I talked to him a few days ago, and I said, hey, Jason, tell me some stories. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, have you been to Haiti? And he says, well, you know, we weren't allowed to go to Haiti. And I said, what? I says, it's right next door. Don't you just walk over the mountain? He says, yeah. He says, but it was a government official policy that we couldn't go to Haiti. And, of course, he then said, but, you know, when you tell that to a 20-year-old, that's the first thing they want to do. He says, yeah, so I've been to Haiti a couple times. And I said, well, what's it like? And he says, well, when you walk over the mountainside, he says, I didn't go into the city, Port-au-Prince, or that's had the earthquake. He says, but you go into these little villages, and he says, it's like you're going back into a Star Wars movie, and it's Raiders of the Lost Ark. He says, everybody's got wrappings around their face because it's so dusty and so dry and so poor, and there'll be a couple people out in the street trying to sell some vegetables on a blanket, just like they were in India, in the slums of India. And he says, you know, and you go there, and it's just dire poverty and dust. He says, it's a terrible place. It's like, he says, it's as I imagined the poorest countries in Africa to be. That's how I described Haiti back then. And the difference is kind of what you were touching on, too. He said, on our side, we had the tourists. We still had pretty much better land. It hadn't been defoiled. And it was prettier, and money went in there. On that side, of course, you had crooked government, and that's a big part of it. You can't blame this just on America. You had a bunch of crooks running the government. But again, it gets back to, if you send people at the grassroots who work at the grassroots, and they give those grassroots villagers and people that are poor some enthusiasm and some ideas on how to just increase a little bit better their cash, their substance crops and their cash crops, kind of like finca and heifer, those kind of volunteers going in there and doing that kind of stuff, then you build a mentality to say, I'm going to get rid of these bad guys. And it reminds me a little bit of, what's that country where, where Sundance Kid went, Bolivia.
Bolivia, sure, yeah.
Yeah, you know, Bolivia is a poor country. They have had 2,000 Peace Corps volunteers, a little bit over 2,000 Peace Corps volunteers. See, I kind of think that when you look at things, if you look at how they throw Peace Corps volunteers in there, you start understanding a little bit of why some good things happen and why some bad things happen. And I'm not saying it's the total barometer, but they've had 2,000 of them, and most of them went to that city, Cochabamba. I don't know if I'm saying it right.
Yes, you are.
But, you know, the city where they had the fight over the water rights, and here a big corporation, Bechtel included, came in and said, we're privatizing your water. And then the people, you know, they're making $100, $70 to $100 a month, and they're having to pay $20 for water. It was more than they were paying for food. And, of course, the uprising started and all that. And when the uprising started, they pulled the Peace Corps out for a while. But I say to myself, you know, they had 2,000 Americans who were probably down there with these poor people saying, Jesus, you know, you're really getting screwed, and we want to help you, and we want to help in some way, and maybe in a little way they did help. That gives those people the cojones, like, or and the insights on how to do better. That never happened in Haiti, and it never happens in a lot of underdeveloped countries like Somalia and Ethiopia and the places where we got problems with terrorists. We don't contain them with surrounding the countries and them with enough do-good American organizations, and we don't have that standing army that says, we're going to get out there ahead of you guys. We used missiles to contain the Russians when we thought communism was a big scare. We ought to use Americans who need jobs, who are sitting on their duff, who are getting soft, and, you know, who, you know, plainly speaking, would get their asses kicked if they had to deal with an Afghani in a street brawl, because those guys live in caves and, you know, live on nothing. And we've been so spoiled, we got popcorn, hot dogs, and beer, and Sunday TV.
Don't apologize. Don't apologize, brother. Preach it, as we say. Preach it. There's so much truth in what you say. And of course, worldservicecorps.us, and that's CORPS, worldservicecorps.us is a great starting place for trying to get some of this going, because in your last email to me, you said something very brief and very succinct, and it probably ought to be a bumper sticker or a slogan or something like that. This won't be the last Haiti.
It's gonna, because the
nature of earthquakes is such that when the earth shifts like that, there's another one will happen soon enough. It's sort of an organic relationship if you sort of broaden the definition of organic. And it won't be the last Haiti. It won't be the last that happens there. It won't be the last poor country in desperate need of aid and assistance. But Haiti itself is, I believe, I think people are beginning to see this as somewhat of a separate and a special issue simply because of the proximity to the United States. There are a lot of people in this country, liberals included, Duane, who are waking up to the notion that we have sat idly by and allowed this to happen. Whether it's the Bush administration going in and ousting Jean-Bertrand Aristide, or the General Smedley Butler figured out a whole bunch of the thesis behind his seminal work, War is a Racket.
Yeah.
Because he was an enforcer in Haiti during the rest of the Marine Corps was over fighting World War I. He was shooting natives in Haiti protecting banana interests or sugar interests. Let's see, it was bananas in Nicaragua. It was sugar in Haiti protecting corporate interests. And he realized that he was nothing but an enforcer. What I'm hoping in terms of awareness will come out of this is that we take a look at it and see if the right wing gets so upset now. Look, it's the Blame America First crowd. Well, if we're the Blame America First crowd, they're the fingers in the ears going la 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 crowd. And frankly, I would rather assign levels of blame where it belongs. And yes, there's been political corruption there, but who fostered the political corruption, Duane? We did, for corporate interests. Cuba would be light years behind where Cuba is if Batista had been allowed to stay. And it would be nothing but gambling hells and the bordellos.
Yeah, I haven't checked on this, but I thought I heard Cuba and Venezuela had their doctors in there the very next day, but you don't hear that on the news.
No, you don't hear it on the news, but you do read some stuff out there, and it was absolutely fascinating. Corey sent this along to me over the weekend. One of the best functioning outfits going on down there is a Cuban hospital. It is the only hospital in Port-au-Prince where an ordinary working day, to the extent they got 80% unemployment, but where just anybody can go up and try to get some level of help, some kind of service, and it is the La Paz Hospital in Port-au-Prince, and there are amazing things being said about it. There's a report, and I'll try to run it a little later in the program just for background. Steve Kastenbaum from CNN filed a report on the La Paz Hospital, and it's referred to it as Cuba's working hospital in Haiti. And oddly enough, they have very little of anything. There's nothing they don't need, but they will not turn people away, and they are doing a tremendous job making things better. That's Cuba. And again, for all of those right wingers who want to say, well, we can't have no health care here, it'll kill business. Are you so sucked up? And I'm not saying this to you, but is America's right wing so sucked up in itself that it is willing to be bested by a Cuban hospital in Port-au-Prince that doesn't even have enough sutures, enough band-aids, and they're doing better work than we're doing? To the extent, Duane, that you mentioned, Americans, we got popcorn, hot dogs and Sunday TV. Are we content with that? And I guess a lot of this country doesn't like gadflyism such as you and I engage in. but I don't think it's an unfair question to ask of the American people. Can we not do better? I mean, we pride ourselves, I see them everywhere. There are these bumper stickers on the backs of cars. This is a Christian nation. Does a Christian nation let this happen? Is this acceptable to a Christian nation? And to, if I were one of them, I would say, no, the answer is no.
Well, you know, when I get in conversations with people like that, I often get back to the, well, what have you done for your country lately? And, you know, the service issue is something we're really missing. When my father's generation, they served either in the military or on the lines making sure that we'd win World War II, you know, and we don't do, and that was the probably last decent war, last war we had to fight, I believe, that we had to be in. And we don't do that service, so we don't have a good take on the world. And we don't even have, like, you know, comfortable people in La Jolla or Hollywood or out here in Marin County where I am. They don't have a good feel on what it's like to live in Appalachia and to live next to a mountaintop that's being removed and be a coal miner. And until enough Americans start doing that service, and these guys who make these remarks like you were just bringing up, I say, well, go do this for a year. You can't do that? Go do Habitat for 2 weeks and then come back and tell me that I'm full of shit. Actually, when I talk to right-wing groups or when I talk to business-oriented groups, like I talk to a lot of Rotaries out here, I don't get I get 98% of the room, it seems like. You know, there are, except the one area where I get some static, and if people read the legislation, you'll see that we have six traditional funding mechanisms, six or eight, and I'm going to probably add another one in the next week or two if I get some time. And then six or eight non-traditional funding mechanisms, and again, excuse me if I mentioned this to you before, but we list the very richest Americans, if this legislation gets up and going, at an American World Service Corps website, we list the Forbes 400 billionaires.
Yes.
We list the celebrity actors and the sports figures, and just do a spreadsheet, and we say, how much will you donate to underwrite the cost of sending Americans to do good at home or abroad so your businesses will do well and so America will be safer in the future by putting down terrorists, winning the hearts and minds of people and doing good? How much will you donate to underwrite the cost so we don't have to use the six traditional taxing revenue raisers? And I probably said to you, you know, there's Gates and Buffett and Soros and more. They have given between 60 and 35% of their income to charitable giving, but the rest are like 0 to 5%. And maybe you remember the answer to this, but I often ask, and I do this, when I do this in front of a Rotary Club, they kind of listen for a while and they're paying attention, and I ask them, I say, what percentage of the Forbes richest 400 Americans, what percentage of their wealth would they have to annually contribute to totally underwrite the like almost $700 billion 27-year cost of putting 21 million Americans into service and rewarding them for their service as we have written in the law? What percentage? Did you guess it last time?
No, I missed it last time.
What, do you know what it is this time?
It has gone past me, but it is some sort of insanely low number. I know that.
Yes, so we call it the Forbes 2% solution. 1.7% of their wealth, and that's at a spreadsheet at the website too. 1.7% of their wealth they'd have to donate annually, and most of the other people are 0 to 5%. Some of the richest people in the country, T. Boone Pickens and, you know, people like that who go around spouting some good sounding things, but they've hardly given any money to charitable contributions. And if they just did that, and I like to jokingly say, well, Oprah would probably say, here's a big chunk of money, make sure I get 50 Peace Corps volunteers at my schools in Africa. And we'd say, done, you know, and that reduces what you have to raise through taxes. And I think it's an interesting step toward, you hear a lot of people say, I only want to pay for things in the government that I want to pay for. Well, are you against this? Or do you think this is a good idea? And again, you get 98% of a Rotary Club meeting saying, yes, they're for it. And then they hear this, and I get a couple of guys out of the room who will say, well, that's not very good. And I say, why is that? And they say, well, because it's embarrassing. You're embarrassing the rich person to force them to give money. Like, I'm not forcing them. You know, they don't have to give. But it's,
and it's only embarrassing if they don't.
Yeah, right. So it's interesting. You say, well, can't you? I think the long run, we're going to have to get back to those tax rates, and that's what our second bill does at the website, the Fair Tax Bracket Reinstitution Act. We got two written up bills that we're trying to get going in Congress, and that kind of reinstalls the tax brackets at the very top for those, that 1% up there. We get close to 50 and 70%.
Oh, you mean what George Bush described as the have-mores?
Yeah, the have-mores, the ones that are making millions and millions every year. We're saying it's got to be more than 39% or 36%. Raise those brackets. That's what paid for World War II, and that's when the middle class grew. When you had those high tax brackets for the very rich under Eisenhower, Truman, and Kennedy, we had a middle class that was growing. Now we got a middle class that's disappearing. So...
It's the absolute truth, Dwayne. And I guess let me ask this: since the last time we spoke, what kind of progress do you have to report as far as the AWSC is concerned?
Well, I had to go on the hump for about 6 months to make some money because we're hurting too, like everybody else is. But we did have some very positive responses from Senator Webb's office, and Senator Webb is a former Marine, and his legislative director and now his new legislative director, we have talked, and they seem to be keen on it. But again, we don't have, I wish, if you have 50 people in Virginia listening, if they'd all write to Senator Webb's office and say, why don't you do that? That would be very helpful. I haven't talked to him for a couple weeks now. And then Congressman Sestak, who's a 4-star rear admiral, who is charismatic and can speak, and he's running against our own Specter for the Senate in Pennsylvania. His legislative director likes it, and I guess this isn't breaching anything. When I said to him, well, do you want me to start talking to other congressional offices who I've already talked to who like it, but who keep saying, well, we're real busy. Like some congresspeople don't have a long-term vision, as we've talked about. And they think, oh, well, we're real busy right now. We like it. If somebody else will be the original sponsor, that'd be great. Well, when I said to Sestak's legislative director, I said, well, you want me to start contacting some of these others? Is he really interested? And he says, well, it's on his desk. It's just he's been so busy, but we don't want you to contact anybody else. And I thought, well, that's strange. Why not? And I said that. I said, well, why not? And he says, because we want to be first out of the box on this. Now, if that's if that's his true sentiment, then that's fine. If he's just blowing smoke on me, then not so good. And Feinstein's office has been talking with me for 4 or 5 years. 4 years, I guess. They want to do things small, and I think I haven't talked to them for months, that the Kennedy, the national service bill that they passed for Kennedy, they kept saying, shouldn't we make this smaller, Dwayne? Shouldn't we? And I keep saying what you had said earlier, we got to do things big. And I said, there are big problems in the world, and they're trying to make the Peace Corps grow to 16,000. When I was in the Peace Corps, it was 14,000, and the world's a lot worse, and it's back down to like 8, and that's the biggest it's been since then. So, these sending just a few little pennies at problems that need dollar bills, and then Boxer's office has introduced legislation for me before, for People's Lobby before, when we tried to start an American-Soviet Peace Corps, where if you were a Soviet and I were an American, we would serve together in the same village. And she did that back in the late 80s. And so I think if I could just get some traction going with a couple things, that if somebody would introduce it, Boxer, I'm sure, would be in favor of it. But she is so busy trying to raise money. And it's sick how...
Right. Sick is the exact word to use, because that is what sickens the whole process, is the fact that that every elected representative, even the good ones, especially the good ones, have to bend over backwards trying to keep themselves going.
They sit down with their staff, and they like it, and they love it, and then they say, go do this, and then you have to go work for several months because the economy's busted things. When you get back to them, they're spending all their time with their senator trying to raise money, and their staff is, I cut you off there.
No, you didn't. You didn't at all. I've got a quote here that Juanita, who was with whom we talked to briefly before you came on the air, that Juanita just sent in. It says, it's a quote, since this is Dr. King's holiday, I think this is more than fitting within the scope of our conversation. A quote from Dr. King via Juanita. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
Yes.
And what at least in, to me, what you're describing, Duane, is a means of doing doing CPR on the spirit of America, frankly, to reinvigorate our sense of national purpose, because what you said was so true a little bit ago about your mom, your dad, that generation, and it applies to me as well, because I'm the young end of those who had World War II parents, and my dad was in the South Pacific aboard an aircraft carrier, and my mother and her sister left these hills and hollers to go and work in a munitions plant. It was in far off Maryland, if you will. And with that being the case, there was a shared sense of purpose. And we don't have anyone yet who has outlined, and many of us hoped that it would be Barack Obama, but so far he has not proven to be that guy. We had hoped that we would have someone who would enunciate that kind of beautiful vision, exquisite vision of American purpose, such as was envisioned by JFK, calling upon a country to serve not only the nation, but to serve the world.
Yes.
And that, you know, it has to be cloaked in terms, that this is a high calling. And I can hear the passion in your voice when you speak about it, Duane, and I can only imagine, and I mean this as no insult, those poor little Rotarians being confronted by you with how relatively how doable this is, and it only wants for funding, and it only wants for more, I don't know, experiential and more real-world weight to be put behind it, and then it happens. It's got their little Rotarian eyes have just got to bug out. I was a Rotarian once. I say this as full disclosure. I was a Rotarian once, and I got drummed out because I couldn't make the meetings every Monday. But I know what those meetings were like, and they were genial, and they were well-intended. But they are also not prone to being too terribly shocked.
Yeah, you know, ironically, at one of these meetings that kind of kicked off this memory, one of the guys quit because he got upset that this guy asked me a question. Two guys asked me questions and trying to attack me on that issue about Forbes 400. And I said, no, I like it. You know, I want them to attack me because I hardly get anybody attacking me. But this guy quit the Rotarians because he said, I'm going to help you. I'm not going to do my Rotarian self. I'm going to help you a little bit here. And he has helped a little bit, you know, so... But when you say the reality of things, you know, it's kind of like when I worked with Gold Star mom Nadia McCafferty, who has burnt her wick at both ends, and she's sick now and run down, and she may have some sort of growth, and she doesn't have health insurance. So trying to work around all that. You say to yourself, and she had said this to me when we first met. I didn't know her from Adam 3-4 years ago. And a guy heard me speak at this philosophical society where they'd let me ramble on for an hour. And so he said, you ought to talk to Nadia McCafferty, and I did. And after I explained this to her on the phone, she immediately signed the petition at the website, which is unusual because most people don't even take the time to sign the petition. You know, and then she said to me, you know, if this program had existed when my son were alive, he'd be alive today. And she said, because he loved kids, and he was over there giving candy to kids. He was giving his cell phone to downed soldiers. He was making $100,000 a year back here. He had two kids of his own, and now he's gone, and he's got two widowed, you know, his widowed wife and two kids gone. But that's the kind of thing. All he wanted to do was serve his country. Right after 9/11, he went into that office. He said, I want to serve my country somehow. I want to do something for my country. He said, but I don't want to leave this country because I got two kids. And the guy said, well, have you guard a nuclear plant? But, you know, 6 months later, the Petaluma Brigade, the engineering brigade, which hadn't had a loss since World War II of life, he's over there training Iraqis and doing six patrols a week and gets killed. And you say to yourself, golly, these Rotarians, these two guys who want to argue with me, you almost want to say, why wasn't it your kid that had to do what Nadius? Then you would look at this and you wouldn't quiver about embarrassing a billionaire, and because you're asking him to give a little money to make sure that the future is safer for your kids. You know, I probably can't roam the world the way I did as a Peace Corps volunteer as safely as I could then. You were an American back when we did the Peace Corps, and you could roam anywhere. And you were like golden because they still remembered the passed away John Kennedy. When I was in the slums in India, Kennedy was gone by the time I was there. But you would be amazed. There'd be pictures of cows, you know, on these slum walls, rooms that are 9 by 13 that hold 5 to 12 people and don't have running water. There'd be pictures of cows on the wall, pictures of Gandhi, pictures of Nehru, and pictures of John Kennedy.
Oh, man.
And when they would say, you know, they never saw a white person in their slum, let alone live in their slum. And the British guys who we played rugby with would take us home some nights, and they'd say, you live here? And I say, yeah, you know, that's why I'm on your rugby team, so I can eat all I can on the weekend and play a little football. And then, you know, you eat so much. There were three of us that would play. They knew we played football in college and basketball and stuff, and so they asked us to play for them. But that was part of our reason for going to that, because we couldn't afford good meals. They had great meals, and if we had a big meal, it would last us for a day or two. But when they go back into that slum, or those kids in that slum, you were safe anywhere you went in India because you were an American and they knew it immediately. Today, you're taking your chances. But if we don't start regaining that sense of who Americans are, and when you say, you know, that it's a teamwork thing, if you played on teams in high school and college, you know, you've had that camaraderie, that sense of oneness. And then maybe you go to college, you have a sense of oneness with your college chums and all that stuff. But, and when you're in the military, the only reason these guys keep going back for three or four tours of duty is because they don't want to let their buddies down. But if you had an American World Service Corps, you get the same kind of camaraderie. But you're not having to blow someone away to get it. And it's going to make it so much easier for our military guys if we had this program up and running. And I think you'd get a lot of what I told about Matt. You'd get a lot of soldiers. Not only did Matt do that, the guy that left, you know, and fought the re-upment, but his buddy. I see him at dinners every now and then. Well, his buddy did the same thing right after he got out of the military. He went into the Peace Corps. I think part of it is you want to cleanse your soul. You just want to do something right and be in a different kind of team that doesn't have to rely on.
I know. Yeah, and I think that's absolutely the truth. Well, I hope Dwayne that folks will go to World Service Corps CORPS.us and review the materials and make contact and try to get this thing off the ground. And if you ever need me to say anything to anyone, you certainly, yeah, because I'm so powerful.
No, but Bob, let me, before you, you know, you once said you knew Kucinich's wife. And I know you mentioned Kucinich early in the show in the Department of Peace. We tried to get them on board with this because we said if there was a Department of Peace, this should be the first thing they do. And if there's a way, if any of your listeners are connected to Kucinich or if they write to Kucinich, have them, you know, mention People's Lobby's American World Service Corps. Give them the website and give them a little push like that. You know, I really want
to. We will. We absolutely will.
Yeah. So, you know, but God, anything you get going really helps with any of your congresspersons.
I'll try a couple of things on the down low, just to see if I can get some interest, in little corners where I get listened to. And, if I have any success, I will certainly let you know. Because oddly enough, it might be one of those places where people listen to an idea who otherwise tend to shut me out. I'm not going to give away much more than that. It's not a secret or anything, but the fact of the matter is there are people who, you know, we work a lot against mountaintop removal here, and a lot of our political elected representatives are, oh, hell no. And you know, basically we're unrepresented. But you take an idea like this, this thing may have traction far out beyond the other issue, mountaintop removal, that I work on. And it may actually garner some interest.
Yeah, you know, even if it's guys that you've bumped their heads and bloodied their skulls, you might say, hey, you know, maybe we could be buddies on this.
Because, well, and that's the thing. There are people out there that you can talk to as long as you don't say MTR to them. You know, and that pisses me off to no end. But it's a political reality. And
well, excuse me, go on.
No, I was just going to say it's a way to start a conversation.
Yeah, and it certainly doesn't help. If you had 100 more AmeriCorps workers working in your schools and throughout Appalachia, you know, I keep saying our schools are hurting, but if I had an American World Service Corps volunteer working with me every class or two or three of them, I'd keep them busy because you always have kids you can have your tutors help and do that kind of things. And that's what this would do. It would flood not only the rest of the world, but America with...
Well, exactly. And, you know, one of our youngest listeners is a brilliant young woman by the name of Cassie, who's just done amazing things as we've watched her go through high school. And I just saw a posting from her in our chat room where she said, you know, I'd volunteer for something like that. And it's creating awareness in that generation, I think, that's also critically important to what you're trying to do, Dwayne.
Yes, and if your friends they Twitter or do Facebook, I hope they spread your show around on that. And, you know, I think you give me a lot of time, and I enjoy talking with you. And both this show and the previous show, I think it gets out a lot of information. If there's a way that they can Twitter or Facebook that, we sometimes don't have time to do all that, but we try.
Absolutely. And if you do have a Facebook page, right?
Yes, I do.
What is it?
What do you mean, what is it? I think it's People's Lobby's Facebook, I think. What is
your Facebook presence? Is it People's Lobby or American
People's
World
Lobby,
Service Corps?
I'm pretty sure that on People's Lobby, that I'm pretty sure that's what it is. Should I put you on that or something?
I will look it up and I'll friend up with it. I would suggest that you probably need to create a freestanding American World Service Corps Facebook presence.
I think it is, but I'll check it now. I'm looking at it here.
And if you've got a Twitter account, you know, the big thing out there, and you know, like one of my colleagues here, John Fox, I hate what Twitter has done to our vocabulary, but you can retweet. So if you get active on Twitter and then you've got a good following, they can in turn retweet to their friends, and you can really get ideas viral that way. So
I've got to learn that. I guess it's Dwayne Hunn. When I just pulled up Facebook, it's got Dwayne Hunn with my picture and my name next to it. Does that mean it's Dwayne Hunn?
Yeah, let me see here. Let me just do a search. Okay, well, there's one. Vote to help the American World Service Corps get volunteers. And here's...
I got your thing up there today. Listen to Dwayne, People's Lobby's executive director and former Peace Corps volunteer, talk with radio host Bob Kincaid about Haiti and more on his radio show today. I put that on my wall. I'm still trying to figure all this stuff out.
Is your hometown Parma?
Yeah, my hometown is Parma.
Okay, there you are. I've just friended you. There we go. So as soon as you approve that, you know, we'll be Facebook friends. But. As annoying as it is, there is no getting around the import, Dwayne, of utilizing this technology, especially for people of Cassie's generation. It's the means of communication, and I don't mean to sound like all old fogey or anything, because a lot of it's still beyond me. But as we go forward, this is how ideas get around now, and so getting busy with Twitter. And getting people to retweet your tweets, which I just can't stand even saying, it just violates the old English major sensibilities in me. I can't help it. But by doing that, you get the idea bigger. But now we're just brainstorming on air, you get the idea. And you know, let me know how to help, and I will continue to help where I can.
Thank you very much, Bob. Thank you very much, and thank you to your audience, too.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure, Dwayne, and best of luck, and I look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Thank you, Bob.
All right, take care. Bye now. Dwayne Hunn of the People's Lobby and the American World Service Corps proposal, World Service Corps, WORLDSERVICE, World Service Corps, C-O-R-P-S, .org. And go have a look, read the stuff, get the resources. To me, it makes an abundance of sense. Think of the money we save on bullets just by creating a little goodwill around the world and doing a little goodwill around the world. I'm not going to stop or break things up any. If you want to jump in on the conversation, you know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Or on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Let us roll merrily ahead. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob. How are you doing?
Hey, Matt. What's up, man?
Well, it seems like on the Martin Luther King holiday, it's almost as if we've gone back in time a little bit. I mean, all of this is sort of reminding me of those William Lederer books, like The Ugly American and Nation of Sheep. It's like Haiti is sort of the upshot of everything that we did wrong in the last 50 years as far as human development abroad. You know, the Peace Corps, when it was created, was supposed to be exactly what we've been listening to you discuss for the last little while. And it's turned out to be not nearly that. It's been sort of a unwanted stepchild for a lot of presidents, hasn't it?
Well, and go ahead and guess the party of the presidents who were busy unwanting it.
Of course.
It sort of went by the boards, as Dwayne mentioned it. But the fact of the matter is, the people who started undoing the Peace Corps for all they were worth were people like Nixon and Reagan. And frankly, Poppy Bush didn't have much interest in it. And George W. Bush himself outright loathed it. You know, on the Haiti page that I was referencing in our conversation, there is mention of the fact, let me see if I can find it here. The Peace Corps reopened its office in Haiti with about 20 volunteers in 1996. Who was president in 1996?
Yeah, that was Bill Clinton.
Yeah. Of course, he and Mrs. Clinton's Secretary Clinton had a rather profound interest in Haiti because that is where they spent their honeymoon in 1975.
Yeah.
And I'm not one of those people who will poo-poo anything that Bill Clinton has to do with, and I just won't do that because I think he had a lot of good instincts, and he and Secretary Clinton had a profound interest in Haiti and Haiti's well-being. And it's in the Bush administration when you find them, you know, screwing Haiti again.
Mm-hmm, yes.
So, no, but you're on track with what you asserted. And it's worldservicecorps.us, by the way. I screwed up.
Worldservicecorps.us. Everybody should write that down.
Yes.
Listen, I think I just put this link up a little while ago in the chat room, and you might have commented on it, but has anyone so far mentioned the Creole pig?
No, they haven't. I saw your mention of it in the chat room, and I looked at the link, and wow, that's an eye bugger.
Yes, this came to me through Twitter, by the way, and I've actually pulled up the New Scientist magazine article about this pig, and it's pretty incredible what occurred here in the 80s. For those of you who haven't heard it, the Creole pig was a breed of pig that was indigenous to Haiti. It was descended from pigs brought over to the New World. And it was very well adapted to the terrain and the sparse vegetation.
So it was brought, as was the case, you know, the Spanish traveled with their dinner on the hoof.
Yes.
And
we did that in the United States, too. That's where all of our wild boars, well, not all of them, but our wild boars in the southeastern United States are descended from, many of them are descended from DeSoto's pig herd that he took with him.
Exactly. And the same thing on the island of Hispaniola. And through the through natural selection, these Creole pigs developed the ability to survive in very sparse circumstances, did they not?
Yes, exactly. They were able to survive on that sparse vegetation down there, and they were able to get otherwise inedible, unusable vegetation. They were able to transform it into nutritious meat. It says here in the New Scientist, it says, before they were wiped out, Haiti's pigs functioned as the peasant's bank account. They stored the tiny surplus of nutrition generated by subsistence agriculture and yielded dividends in the form of piglets, which could be sold for cash or eaten. The Haitian pig was descended from medieval European breeds. In the 17th and 18th centuries, Caribbean pirates carried them to feast on between attacks on colonial shipping. Like the Haitians themselves, the descendants of slaves declared independence in 1804, etc., the Haitian pigs were tough. They survived mainly on a diet of otherwise unusable plant material. Moreover, the pig was central to the peasants' religion as to their economy. In voodoo traditions, the sacrifice of a black pig seals contracts. What apparently happened is that during the 70s, the African swine fever showed up on the island of Hispaniola. It was at first just in the Dominican Republic side of the island, but it spread down a river into Haiti. And it was at some time after that in the early 80s that the United States decided that all these pigs should die and be replaced with good American pigs, good, clean American pigs, which gained the title from the people of Haiti started calling them the four-footed princes, because these pigs require clean drinking water that's unavailable to 80% of Haitians. They require imported feed that costs $90 a year at a time that per capita income is about $130 a year. They require vaccination. They require special roofed pig pens. In other words, they were
So in other words, we repigulated, I guess. We repopulated the porcine population of Haiti with Arnold Ziffel.
Yes. And the upshot of this was that by eradicating this Creole pig, you basically guaranteed the poverty of these peasants was not going to improve. It was only going to get worse.
But they would be doing their part. They would be doing their part for the great American corporatist machine by spending a great deal of their meager income on American pig feed.
Exactly. At one time, most peasants in Haiti kept these pigs. They used these pigs, the piglets. They sold them in order to pay for things like, I don't know, school books for their kids. So you're looking at how the entire country society outside of Port-au-Prince, the rural society of Haiti, was basically upended to prevent, supposedly, this African swine fever from reaching the United States. Now, according to the New Scientist, you don't necessarily have to kill all the pigs in Haiti in order to stop African swine fever. What you do is you isolate the herds that are infected and you kill the infected herds.
Can I just ask one really stupid question, Matt?
Go ahead.
I mean, I know that we have a totally screwed up immigration policy with regard to Haiti. But was there a great flood of live Haitian pigs being brought to the U.S.?
No.
How was it going to get here?
The worry is always with transmission is that you are going to have somebody who goes to Haiti and steps in the dirt and picks this up on their shoe and brings it back to the United States. And in truth, yes, that is how these diseases can spread. They can spread through completely innocuous modes of transmission. But again, you don't kill every pig on the island to solve this problem. You just find the herds that are infected, and you take care of those herds.
But of course, we use the sledgehammer approach because, God forbid, we should.
It even gets worse.
Dear.
How they did this? Remember that Haiti at the time was under Papa Doc Duvalier.
Right, and then there was Baby Doc.
And what they did was they got the Duvalier government to do this for them. Now, supposedly, every farmer was going to be remunerated the price of the pigs that were killed. So what Duvalier wound up doing is his guys would go around killing the pigs and giving these peasants some or not all of the money, or none at all. So basically Duvalier was enriching himself off of bounties on pigs. That's what this turned into. Most of the money spent to slaughter these pigs probably wound up in foreign bank accounts. And it's probably keeping Papa Baby Doc Duvalier in. Is he still alive? Even
No, I don't think so.
is probably keeping his family, his grandkids, in clover, is what it's doing. So this is just basically something like a $150 million rat hole that we filled with dead pigs. Now, the best part of this article to me, from the New Scientist, reading through this, is that the French, of all people, have had an effort going on since 1984 to reintroduce, to breed the Haitian Creole pig back into existence and put it back on the island. And they have run into nothing but resistance from Americans and from Haitian authorities, who, of course, are in the pocket of the agribusiness. So the French, of all people, have been trying to fix this horrible situation for 25 years and have been held back by, guess who? Same usual suspects. It says here, 400,000 American pigs were imported into Haiti. Less than 200,000 survived today. Now, you tell me how that happened.
Dude, I don't think I got it.
You don't. No, you don't have to. And pigs are a species that reproduces like wildfire. Am I correct?
Yes, they are an opportunistic species, to say the very least.
And it says here also that the peasantry began to raise goats, which was also bad for the foliage. They had used to feed the pigs mangoes, which once the pigs were gone, they had no use for the mango trees, so they started cutting down the mangoes, which led to the soil erosion. It says here that the pigs were a major factor in keeping the soil nutrient rich, because they were allowed to run free. So we have here kind of a miniature story of human development failures. And it actually, this article calls it one of the greatest technology transfer failures in history. I was completely unaware of this until about 2 hours ago.
And since then, your eyes have been bugging out, right?
My eyes have been bugging out. This is pretty much emblematic of everything that I ever knew from reading about the failures of American development episodes in the 50s and 60s. And always.
Yeah, how to screw an ecosystem.
Yes, how do you screw an ecosystem? How do you fail?
But wait, time out, throwing a red flag. It's only a screwed ecosystem if you're not making money off of the screwing.
Precisely.
Who are the usual suspects here? Who makes the $130 a year pig feed?
Right.
Would that be an American agribusiness, an American food corp, Purina, maybe?
You know, I don't even want to call these guys Americans anymore because they're really not.
Well, no, they aren't.
They're global, massive corporations. They have no loyalty to our country or our flag or our community. You know what they are? They're giant sociopathic machines is what they are. They have humans working in them, but they're not human.
The corporations? No, they are some sort of immortal alien species.
Yes. They are immortal, and yet somehow they have rights that somehow trump mine as an actual living, breathing human being. I don't know how that happened.
A little galling, isn't it?
It's a little galling.
But every time... You know, every time you see something that looks like a manifest horror, a giant mistake being made, if anywhere in that process, Matt, you can find someone making a buck off of the quote-unquote mistake, then you have to take mistake out of the equation. This is not a boating accident.
No, it's not. Not an accident at all.
You know, if you've got some sort of indigenous, I mean, look, and this is not the aluminum foil hat portion of the program. We had honest to God policy in Iraq, and it may still exist for all I know.
Mm-hmm.
That said, that there in Iraq, where the agriculture of wheat, barley, and rye first happened about 5,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And where, you know, the seeds are native and have been produced via a sort of intentional natural selection over the years by agricultural, you know, by peasant farmers.
Mm-hmm.
The Bush administration made a determination that we were going to drag those, Iraqi farmers kicking and screaming into the 20th century so that they could have some genetically modified Monsanto wheat crops. And it would be the, and it would be the only wheat seed they would be allowed to plant.
You know, it fascinates me.
It's a recipe for famine.
That when they went over there and set up the green zone, one of the first things they started to do was to shut down state-owned businesses that were losing money. Well, sure, you shut down the state-owned socialist business that was losing money. You've also put 400 guys out on the street pissed off at you with AK-47s in their houses.
Hey, but you know...
Tell me how this works.
Oh, I know. I know. But, you know, we got to run government. Remember, do you remember the 2000 election, Matt? It seems like... God, it seems like it was 10 years ago. I remember this pig-eyed, jug-eared, you know, beady-eyed little freak with a phony Texas accent running for office and saying really lunatic acid flashback things like, well, I want to run the United States like a business. That's what we need. I don't want to be your president. I want to be CEO of America. And I want us to run America as good as that other great American corporation Enron has run. We need to be running America like Enron.
And if you go just back four more years, you can remember, you gotta get out of the hood and fix it. Yeah, these very simplistic notions of how government works. This very simplistic notions of, you know, we just kill these pigs and send some good Iowa hogs down there to replace them.
What they need's a, they don't need no Creole pig. Them Creole, you know how it is with that Creole food, is too spicy. What they need's a few good Poland Chinas.
That's right. Says here that Baby Doc is still alive, by the way. Someone just put the link up in the chat room.
Oh, dear God, where is he?
Oh, well, let's see.
I don't see him volunteering to go back and help with the recovery effort. No, I got two separate ones. Yep, there it is from Ron and Raleigh. Baby Doc is indeed still alive, born 1951, just like me. He's pledged 5 million pounds to disaster relief. Well, bless my soul. In other words, he's going to give back to the people of Haiti some of the money he stole from them.
That's right. Yes. Well, it's nice that he's been keeping all that money all these years.
And, of course, Susan, in addition to being our one of our news ninjas, is also a resident cynic. Hey, Bob, Baby Doc is still alive. In fact, he just announced that he is sending millions to the Haiti relief effort. And here's the cynical portion of the program. Why don't I believe that?
There's a wide difference between saying you're going to give 5 million francs and actually giving 5 million francs.
Or pounds.
Or pounds, or whatever.
Yeah, lubs. Lubs, LBS, lubs.
Euros.
Yes.
I'm going to give 5 million good wishes is what he's going to do.
I'm going to think a lot about giving 5 million pounds. But, yeah, right. Give good wishes. Road to hell. Paved. You know, it's asphalt all the way.
Yeah. I just thought that this was a really interesting little thing that I had been alerted to today by Twitter. And that's an example of what Twitter can do. Twitter and all these social networks, they can provide information. They can spread these things around fast. I mean, just 2 hours ago, I was reading about this for the first time, and now.
So do you just tweet like crazy?
I tweet probably for about a half hour every day. I log on a couple of times during the day. I pull links. I send out some tweets. I won't say that I tweet all the time, but it's a fairly good traffic builder.
Well, how about doing me a favor if you don't mind?
Sure.
How about sending out a tweet that says something like, "For the next Haiti." And then www.worldservicecorps.us.
You know what? I'm going to do that right now. I'm even going to use a hashtag. Woohoo!
Ooh, I wish I knew what one of those was.
For the next Hey, please, you can hear me typing.
Yes, yes.
All right. http://www.
World Service Corps, C-O-R-P-S, .us.
Corps.us.
Call, and then maybe call your congressman.
Call your Congress Twitter.
There you go. There you go.
Now, as a matter of fact, I wanted to ask
you. Matt Osborne, you are a tweeting stud.
I am a tweeting stud. Woohoo! I wanted to ask you about something else related to Congress. I sent you an email over the weekend. Our blogging network has just gotten a new voice, a guy named Mike Stark. Your readers may be familiar with his work.
He has
a camera. He goes into the Capitol Dome, and he talks to representatives and senators and gets them on video and puts them up on his website. He's a citizen journalist of the First Order. And I was wondering if maybe you or your listener, the people in the chat room, had any suggestions about people that he should ask about H.R. 1310.
Very good idea. And I think you have just put it out there to try to find out just exactly what that might be.
Yes. Now, I, of course, I'm at osborneinc.com, OSBORNEINK.com. I'm hooked up on Twitter. My email address is on there. I'm also hooked up on Facebook and YouTube as well. And I'm in the chat room, and you're on the air, and if anybody wants to offer suggestions, first of all, just the name of the representative, what state they're from, and also what kind of questions would you ask them? Because that's really what it comes down to. Mike Stark needs good questions to ask. So if you or your listeners...
I thought about it when I saw the email, Matt. Let me just tell you where my brains went with it. The question is, it's not one of getting the people who are behind it to push it harder.
Right.
The question is finding out why we can't get it out of committee, and I've got to find out the name of the woman who is holding it up right now. And I'm sure someone will tell me in a minute, most likely, because it's being held up in the House, H.R. 1310 is. But for those who don't support it or won't support it, and, you know, Parker Griffiths is a great starting place for this.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the question. What would you do if 3.5 million pounds of high explosives were being set off in your state every week?
3.5 million pounds of explosives. That's a good...
Because, you know, that's our reality. 3.5 million pounds of the same high explosives that Timothy McVeigh used on the Murrah Federal Building are used on West Virginians every week.
Uh-huh.
No, I'm sorry.
My question.
It works out to a Hiroshima every 9 days.
Hiroshima every 9 days. Okay, we'll make note of that. Zero every 9 days.
What would you do if Pearl Harbor was happening 22 times a day in your district?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are the equivalences.
My question to Stark was, and I had talked to him about Parker Griffiths by email, because he's the one that I know best, and he's the one that I think you can really nail, because I want to ask Parker Griffiths, the former oncologist, what he thinks about a mining practice that produces some of the worst cancer clusters in America.
Hey, there's a good one. That works. And by the way, that's per day, not per week. That
per day?
Half, yeah.
Wow. Wow, wow. Just to reach little 1 and 2 foot seams of coal.
Yes.
Pathetic.
Yeah, and I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but I've mentioned it a couple of times on the program. The Indians are getting into the act.
The who?
The Indians. The Indian subcontinent? The place.
Oh, yeah, I heard about this.
The place that gave birth to Gandhi?
Yeah.
They've signed a contract with Don Blankenship to bring hell on earth a little closer to us all.
Oh, goodness. Are they going to be...
The Indians!
Are they going to be doing it in India, or are they going
to... No, they're going to be doing it here. They've signed a contract to buy the coal that Don Blankenship blows out of the mountains.
So, in other words, we do this mountaintop removal to keep the jobs here and to keep America strong with energy so that we can export the coal to India.
Right, because coal is our is one of our best national security resources. We've got coal in America to keep us nationally secure for hundreds of years. That's why we're selling it to India and China.
This reminds me of when you look at a map of Alaska. I mean, your listeners can look at their hand right now. Look at your hand. Your thumbnail is the amount of Alaska that is not open to being drilled. The rest of your hand is open to being drilled. But where does this oil wind up? Does it go all the way around the tip of South America? Because you can't get a supertanker through the Panama Canal.
True.
Does it go all the way around the south of Tip America to the Gulf Coast? No. This oil that we drill out and take out in these tankers from Alaska winds up in Japan and Malaysia and China, which is only about 6,000 miles away as opposed to a 15,000-mile trip around the southern tip of South America. Yeah, right. It's America's energy security that we're worried about.
Yeah,
right.
not so much.
Right. Well, Bob, I've been on here for long enough. I'm going to go ahead and get off the air. Thank you very much. And, again, to your listeners, if you have a suggestion, questions that should be asked and who should be asked them, please let me know.
Absolutely. And Matt, what is your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is Osborne Inc.
Very good. Because it's already been retweeted at least once.
I know. Texas Betsy already did it.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, Betsy's great.
All right. Thanks, Matt. We'll talk soon.
To you later.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Matt Osborne, blogger extraordinaire of Osborne Inc., OSBORNEINK.com, OsborneInc.com. Mighty sharp, mighty busy, and if he's not careful, he's going to wind up famous. Just remember us when you are, Matt. Just remember us when you are. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Hello? Okay, that sounded like silence, so we will try the other line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Are you talking to Dave?
I'm talking to Dave.
Well, Dave, this is the day that voice out of your past.
Yeah, long time no talkie.
Well, a long time since I've been able to even listen to you, but it's awfully good to be able to do so once again. Yeah, this is Dave from up in Humboldt, Northern Cal.
Yeah, I recognized your voice immediately.
You do, huh? Well, you've got an excellent memory, because it has been a while. One of the subjects that popped into my head, although you haven't been dealing with it much today, but we've got an election coming up here tomorrow, and I am one who's been totally convinced, as you may recall, that elections are being regularly rigged, and they're being rigged by the corporate power elites, in effect the Republicans. And they have the ability to invade computers, and voting machines are computers. They can go in and flip them around and do what they want with them. And right now, it's a tight situation between Republicans and Democrats in our Congress. So,
well, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, Dave, because it reminded me of a promise that I made earlier today. After my show ends, of course, virtually the whole Horn audience goes over and listens to Malloy.
Mm-hmm.
And Malloy will be having Brad Friedman on his program tonight.
And Brad is the one who's knowledgeable on what we're talking about.
Brad is the go-to guy on this stuff. I mean, in the whole country, Brad is the go-to guy.
Yeah.
And so I expect that Mike will be talking to him at significant length about what sort of shenanigans we can expect out of Massachusetts tomorrow.
You know, it's so late to be able to do anything about it, but I think that people should be aware because it's better than 2-1. Registered Democrats, for the most part, it's a very progressive, liberal section of the country, that is to say. I think Rhode Island and Massachusetts are the two most liberal states in the United States, and if they suddenly just barely squeak it over to become a Republican senator, I'm going to be very suspicious of that, because I know what they can do with computers.
Well, not just that, but I got an email from Lottie, who lives in Massachusetts, earlier today. And he said, you know, Bob, go and listen to this stream. And it was the station up there that had it had preempted Hartman's program to do local election coverage, and it was disturbing in the extreme, Dave. It really was, because what Lottie mentioned and what I heard was true. It was running about 50-50 in the calls.
Yeah, well, if you believe that, because they can rig the polls going in, they can rig the polls.
Yeah, but this was the local liberal radio station. They can't rig the calls going into the station.
Well, the station, okay, no. If they're taking the poll right off the air, that would be a much more credible poll.
And what's, but, you know, I'm with you. I have no, if there are electronic or especially touchscreen machines in use in Massachusetts, that makes things all the dodgier and all the dicier. And frankly, the other thing is that that side, the teabaggers and the birthers and the deathers and the tenthers and the booger eaters and the like, they're more motivated because hate is one of the most profound motivational tools in the human experience. And they are motivated by a profound hate for that brown man in the White House. And as a consequence, you've got people who have been phone banking from Michigan. You've got people who've been coming from Rhode Island to Massachusetts. You've got a real problem on your hands. And it ought, and I want to be clear about this, it ought not be a problem. You know, the Washington Post noted that, Ms. Coakley, the Democratic nominee, had a 30-point lead in that race. And it's now a dead heat. She had a 30, but what the Washington Post said, Dave, was she had a 30-point lead and she ran, and she ran her campaign like it. You know, this is one of those where she needs to be going door to door. Do you know where she was last week? Or maybe week before last?
Well, I don't think she's a good campaigner, but I think it would take an absolute total disaster. She'd have to be caught and involved in some kind of a child molest or a rape or something to be able to lose the kind of a support a Democrat would enjoy right now. I mean, Ted Kennedy was good for Massachusetts. And for a long time, he voted the way I thought he should have voted on everything, virtually. He was a person who believed in giving and caring. The Republicans believe in taking and receiving, and to hell with the people, to hell with the poor. We got ours, and we're planning to keep it. So rigging an election is not beneath their ethics. They will.
No, and you know, one of the things we need, and this sounds kind of silly, but it's true, we need a weather report for the general Massachusetts area tomorrow, because Americans are real lazy about going to the polls, and God knows if there's a drop of rain, half the liberals will stay home. You know, the right wingers, you know, by God, it doesn't matter. If there was a nuclear radiation accident, they'd put on their little aluminum foil suits and go to the polls.
Yeah, well, you know, most of the Republicans that are voting that way, they're stupid, because their whole thing is rigged to benefit the millionaires and the billionaires. And most registered voters are not millionaires and billionaires. Somebody that may believe in something they've heard on the Limbaugh radio show or something. But
yeah, working stiffs. You know, Lottie is noting in the chat room, Dave, that the liberal radio station involved, and I can't remember the call sign right now. That I heard was Jeff Santos. And Jeff Santos fought like crazy to get liberal radio back into Massachusetts. Can you imagine that, having to get liberal radio back into Massachusetts?
Right.
I mean, we're not talking about getting liberal radio into Birmingham, Alabama. Liberal radio in Massachusetts. And it was a struggle. And that, you know, I think what you're seeing in Massachusetts is, God forbid, a little bit of a perfect storm taking shape. You've got WWZN is what it was, by the way. You've got conservative corporations controlling the media themselves, in Massachusetts and elsewhere. You've got a highly motivated gang of political thugs, for all intents and purposes, in the teabaggers, etc. You've got a tone deaf, a Democratic candidate who 2 weeks ago was at a champagne fundraising reception in Washington, D.C., instead of knocking on doors and going to I don't know, the boiled cabbage dinners down here. It's a bean dinner. I'm trying to figure out what the equivalent would be in Massachusetts. Instead of going out on the hustings in Massachusetts, and you've got this eye candy boy toy running against her, that stuff doesn't stick to. I mean, this guy, he was one of my nominees for Moran Monday, Dave. This guy asserted that Barack Obama was born out of wedlock. He accused the president of the United States of bastardy.
Yeah, well, that's no surprise. I mean, they've been accusing him of everything since day one. That he could be the president that they really should hate, the one who is actually acting on behalf of the people and not caving in to some many of their demands. I want to value Barack Obama very much. I want him to be what we truly need. But
I know where you're going. And by the way, this was just provided to me by Lottie. Tomorrow's prediction for instance, Beverly, Massachusetts, is for 36 degrees Fahrenheit the high, 25 degrees Fahrenheit the low, and a 70% chance of precipitation. That don't bode well.
Well, I don't know if they can control the weather, but I think it's something, it's not the weather that's going to affect this election. It is going to be a little high-tech computer.
Right, and that's the whole point. The reporting right now is that she's 7 points down, Coakley is. And so you assume a margin of error around plus or minus 4%, plus or minus 4 points, that means she's down at best 3 points. Which means that's within the margin of working with for electronic voting systems. So, you know, I don't think there's anything untoward in your assertion that there will probably be some electronic voting shenanigans.
Well, Bob, I personally am of the belief that if the people go to the polls in Massachusetts tomorrow and 2-1 vote Democratic for the Democratic senator, it is within the capability of these tech goons to flip enough votes that the Republican wins anyway. And even make it look like it was kind of a real close.
See, I don't think they can credibly flip it far much further out beyond 10 points.
I wish I was sincerely hope you're right, but what's to limit them? If they can flip votes, they can flip votes.
I'm learning stuff here, Dave. There's other stuff to be dealt with. Lottie's telling me that union people are against her there in Massachusetts. If you've lost the unions in Massachusetts, you've lost. And it won't even require any skullduggery with the machines. If the traditional they don't even have to vote for the Republican. If the traditional electoral base of the Democratic Party, like organized labor, stays home, you don't need any electronic magic. You lose.
Well, I wonder, does Lottie know that to be true? Or is this what's coming out, a rumor, or is it?
Well, no, I mean, he's basing it on what he's reading up there, and I mean, he's ground zero. So, you know, and everything that follows from it is a real nightmare. You know, goodbye health care bill, goodbye everything. And by the way, the guy running against her, the eye candy, Brown, is married to a reporter from WCVB-TV named Gail Huff. You know, as far as the media is concerned, the fix is in. And this ought to be easy for anybody who knows how to run a campaign that's not absolutely tone deaf. My God, this guy voted against 9/11 rescue workers. Even the teabaggers shouldn't be able to get around that, because that's the one where they take their hats off and put their flags up and sing, you know, Lee Greenwood music.
Well,
it's going to take an absolute miserable screw up to lose this, and the sad thing is, it may well have already happened. On a separate note, Dave, I'm being asked a couple of times in the chat room, can you give us an update on Alice?
Alice is doing really well. She's in her mid-90s now, and she's no longer able to jump rope and what, but she's as alert as she ever has been, and she used to value very much listening to Head On, and she's no longer been able to. Well, none of us have been able to hear. That if you're not familiar with how the technical capabilities of these Patriot Act troopers, they can block with it. They can jump into your computer and do what they want with it. I've had a tech here that's been working with me for some time, changing things and getting it and switched me over to a whole different system. So for a while, I'm now able to do it. But
well, please convey to Alice that we love her dearly and that she has been asked after with much good wishes and warm feelings.
Thank you so much. I'm sure she will be happy to hear that. She used to value. She called in from time to time. She was able to.
Oh, I absolutely treasured my opportunity talking to Alice.
Yeah, she was good. Most everybody that knew her, she still was active with the Unitarian Fellowship here, and they all ask about how she's doing, and they never hear her on the radio anymore. She hasn't been able to do much of that. How is your crew, Bob? How is Agnes? How is the rest of the?
We are. We're just holding up under the strain, I guess, Dave. We're managing to through the kind and incredible goodness of the folks who share their time with the Horn. We're able to keep this thing on the air. As far as the family in general, I guess we're okay. Margie is getting over having her wisdom teeth extracted. Doodle's got a bum ankle right now. Ferg has cabin fever. Agnes is as busy can be. Being God's own grandmother to the little ones here. You know, we got two grandchildren on the ground.
Please let them know that they have received their love from Humboldt County and Northern Cal, because there are some awful good people. I wonder, did his guy James still with you? Was Mark Levine still with you?
Well, Guy James has been off the air for a while because of some rather ugly internet problems, but hopes to be coming back to the air. And I think Guy and I, at least the last plan, and I'm hoping it still is the plan, Guy and I plan to do a broadcast from Washington, D.C. next week.
With grave suspicion on any technical electronic problems he's encountering. He's had more than his share for a long time.
He has, and it has to do with the kind of connection he has, and he's at the mercy of I guess Comcast. But with any luck at all, we will be broadcasting live I guess Thursday and Friday of next week from Washington, D.C.
Well, I'll stay with you guys as long as I'm permitted, and it's awfully good to be hearing you again.
Well, it's so good to hear from you, Dave, and so good to know that Alice is okay. That's a real shot in the arm for us this evening.
Yeah, I visit with her every day, and she's such a precious human being, still so alert. She's in a home that cares for a half dozen ladies in a similar age group and whatnot, and she's the heart, the humor of that program.
Oh, bless her heart. Well, I tell you, do please tell her that we asked after her and we think the world of her.
Not to make it long with her, but maybe I'll get her to call and just let her say hello and let her know that she still values you folks.
That would be just lovely, Dave.
All right. I want to see if I can do that.
All right. You take care.
Take care of yourself, everybody.
All right. And we'll be on the air tonight with election coverage, so if you can dial us in, please do so.
We'll certainly try.
All right. See you, Dave.
Take care.
Bye now. From Northern California, that's Dave. I hadn't heard from him in a long time, and I'm glad to know that he and especially Alice are doing okay. You know, it's funny the way the minds work of folks on the Horn. Just a few minutes ago, and I've got a time stamp on the chat room. At let's see, let me find it here. Gotta find it. Ah, there it is. At 8:05 p.m., Lottie in the chat room posted the following. See, you guys don't sat. See, I'm ruining it, the professional broadcaster. Quote, see, you guys down south don't hold the monopoly on stupid hicks. We have more than our share here, too, meaning in Massachusetts. So then I go to my email box and I find a note at 8:15 p.m. from David in South Carolina that says the following. If Massachusetts elects Brown, they have no right to tell us how stupid we are here in South Carolina for electing demented Sanford, Graham, etc. It's like having some sort of deep scanning electron microscope and just watching the waves of human thought energy just and I don't know, maybe it's like those fiber optic cables at the end of the ponytails in Avatar. We were talking about Avatar earlier. We're making it happen right here. How about us? And let's see, let's roll onward and see what's still cooking. No. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Kevin from Brooklyn.
Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Fine. Did you get the writing?
No, I looked for it and it never came.
Okay, let me get you an email address.
Yeah, bobkincaid@gmail.com.
Okay, and I'll send it directly to you.
Yeah, do please.
Okay, I just want to double check on that. And, you know, we'll talk about a thing or two, particularly in Massachusetts. I really don't think this Bob guy is going to win. I think the people in Massachusetts are just way too intelligent.
Oh, I want you to be right. You don't know how badly I want you to be right.
I really, bigotries they have up there. Trust me. I've been up there a few times. But I just think but again, to me, it's like that English bigotry where there's a certain degree of intelligence to it, if there is such a thing. And I just think they cannot allow their bigotry to crowd their better judgment. You know, I really don't. You know, it's just, I really cannot think that way. And, you know, because have you seen Springfield, Massachusetts?
Not personally.
Okay, it's basically a ghost town now. The only thing is the state capital is there, so they have to have a few government compounds. You know, government entities. But at one time, Springfield was a thriving town until the 80s.
Ah, you mean it was a thriving town, BR, before Reagan?
Exactly. And it's the same thing with a lot of northeastern towns. You know, it's just, I cannot see this happening. I really refuse to see this. There's too many colleges and universities in Massachusetts for this clown to win. And yes, I see MSNBC trying to thumb the scales in his favor.
I've mentioned it before, Kevin, but a long time ago, Robert C. Byrd said to me, son, there's only two ways to run an election, unopposed and scared to death. And so I took that to heart, and I'm scared to death because you know that old saying, you will never go broke underestimating the American people?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you will also never go broke overestimating the motivation of a bunch of pissed off right-wingers.
Yeah, well, I don't think that there are that many in Massachusetts. There are too many gay couples, too much... You know,
but are they going? But those people are all there, Kevin. And I'm not just arguing with you for argument's sake.
Yeah.
Those people are all there, and I don't mean those people like those people. But those groups are all there. But it's not enough for them to be there. They've got to be motivated enough to get their feet on the street and go to the polling place. They've got to have something to care about. And on the one hand, the birthers, tenthers, baggers, and booger eaters. They think that they're saving America. On the other hand, Coakley doesn't inspire a great deal of doesn't inspire inspiration. And as such, we have to deal with that fact. And I simply don't know if she is going to bring the people out.
I just don't see it happening in Massachusetts. I really don't. Yes, there are big issues there. Prime example of what happened over the summer. You know, with the whole Bear Summit nonsense, but I just cannot see.
It's like something out of a science fiction movie.
Yes. I just cannot see this clown win.
I hope you're right. Okay, and by the way, I just received the Haiti piece.
Yeah. Oh, okay, thanks.
So I will send this forthwith. I will send this forthwith, and we'll get it up on the blog.
Yeah, I just cannot see this happening. You know, it's just... I just didn't...
But, Kevin, how much of I can't see this happening is a function of you can scarcely imagine the misery that flows out of it?
Oh, yeah. And that's the thing. Because... I guess this is where my faith in my little faith in this country I still have left, and it's draining quickly in the few days, in the few weeks that I have left staying here, is that I just cannot believe bigotry is that powerful of a force in this country. That's what I'm getting at.
But you kind of know that it is, don't you? And again, hate is a profound motivator. I mean, here's a guy who voted for a golf course at the same time he said he couldn't afford to vote for 9/11 responders.
Exactly.
And apparently, by 7 points or so, Massachusetts voters are okay with that. Now tell me that doesn't just make you want to tear at your hair and run screaming around the room.
I know. But then again, this is the same state who bought Bordis Kerry, who just, you know, kind of wimped out of Ohio. You know?
Yeah. I know.
A lot of his skull and bones.
And if, as Dave asserts, there's going to be voting machine skullduggery, does Ms. Coakley have the starch to stand in and fight if it looks like she's been done dirty? And as Lottie notes in the chat room, let's face it, if Brown wins, it's because Coakley screwed up. He ought to be nothing more than a placeholder candidate for the Republican Party. He ought not be able to win an election for dog catcher. But here he is on the possible verge of becoming the U.S. Senator from Massachusetts and screwing you and screwing me and screwing my children and my grandchildren and my friends and my neighbors, screwing all of us.
And, you know, I'm sorry to rub this in, but they ain't definitely screwing me. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, well, you've got the passport and the plane ticket.
Yeah, you know, I don't mean to be rubbing it in.
No, that's okay. I like salt.
Yeah, that enough. You know, I've had enough. I'm not a masochist.
Right, and you know the definition of insanity. So you refuse to be insane, and you go somewhere else.
And that's all there is to it at this point in my life.
Well, you know, if you go to Jamaica, you're still in the same time zone. You're still in the same hemisphere. And you'll still have a good internet connection.
I'm not going to Jamaica.
Oh, that's right. You're going to Austria or Czech Republic.
No. Right now it's now between China and South Korea. I'm waiting on an offer from South Korea. I've already been offered China.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
I'd take South Korea.
Well, I'm holding out for South Korea. If not, I'm going to China. And not necessarily that I, you know...
You're not going to work for Google, are you?
No.
Because the jobs may be disappearing at Google in China.
No. And, you know, I know Chinese have their problems with censorship and all that, but you know one thing I can say about China? China's saving grace with all the problems they have as far as human rights and all that. This is the one thing I can see about China, being that that New York City has a large Chinese American community. And, you know, I get a lot of news from the politics of China. The one thing is that China's legislative and corporate elite, legislative, government elite, and corporate elite is not run by a bunch of two-year-olds.
No, they're sharper than us by a factor of about a million. And remember, there are more English speakers in China than there are in all of the United States combined.
Exactly. And they're demanding more. And that's what I'm going out there to do, teach them English. But the fact of the matter is that the Chinese know what they're doing cannot go on forever.
And they're making and they're making plans accordingly.
Exactly. You know, they know they cannot allow workers to live in misery and all that. And that's where the hope lies in China. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, they know it. And that's why they're getting in early on so many things. Thinking 20, 30 years down the road.
True. True. Very true. Well, Kevin, I need to roll on, but keep us posted, please. And I hope you're right. I really want you to be right about this.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I'll call you on Wednesday.
All right. You take care.
Okay, brother.
Bye now. That's Kevin calling from Brooklyn, and we will keep things rolling right after a quick email. This rolling in from and Lottie can probably address this far better than I. This rolling in from David in South Carolina. I can't see how there's not a Kennedy machine in Massachusetts after all these years. That's a lot of connections. And I don't think it's not that the, I don't think it's that there's not a Kennedy machine. It's that there's a lack of motivation on our side, and there's a whole bunch of motivation on the other one. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. It's Cassie.
Hey, Cassie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm holding up.
Okay. I have a question about Haiti and a question about Massachusetts.
Okay.
So, the Republican who's running in Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
there's all this really, really negative stuff out there about him.
Yes.
But all of the negative stuff just seems to be on the lefty blogs. Do people in Massachusetts know about it? Are they getting real information? And what lies are they getting? Like, if it's not just close, but he's in the lead, do people really, like, know what's going on?
That is a question that is probably best answered by Lottie. And I will wait for the internet latency to work through and for him to then type, and we'll get an answer. But remember, this guy's wife is a reporter for a TV station. He's plugged in.
Do they make her not report on her husband's campaign? I mean, like, isn't that...
Oh, I'm sure there's some sort of...
Isn't that illegal, or...
I'm sure there's some sort of cone of silence around her. But those things are idealistic at best. You know what I'm saying? Don't do that, don't do that, and then they do it.
Mm.
Because everybody still has...
After he loses.
Right, and everybody still has to work with her, right?
Uh-huh.
So... Lottie is just answering in the chat room. He says, people here are just as stupid as anywhere else. That's not a good sign.
No. They could be as stupid as Texans. That wouldn't be good.
Well, a lot of Texans, not all Texans.
Not all Texans.
Right.
Right. Look at who Texans elect.
Yeah, but I mean, you're right. It is on the lefty blogs.
The rest of you.
Pardon?
We sent George Bush to the rest of you.
Yeah, just to get rid of, get him out of Austin. Another case of somebody getting some relief. But you're right.
It is on the
lefty blogs. I mean, the stuff about him supporting the tax subsidized golf course at the same time that he was denying financial aid to Red Cross rescue workers who volunteered for 9/11 recovery efforts. How could you possibly send somebody like that to the United States Senate? How could you?
Yeah. Did you see that one of the supporters at his rally yesterday said that he should or that they should put a curling iron up Coakley's butt.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. They said that they're like a rape joke, like an anal rape joke, and he smiled.
Apparently he does a lot of smiling. He smiled when somebody asked him, he said this on tape back in 2008. He said, Barack's mom had him when she was, what, 18 years old? And whoever he was talking to said, and married? And then he replied, well, I don't know about that. He accused the President of the United States of being a bastard. I think we know who that one is, and it ain't Barack Obama.
No.
That's just, but the curling iron?
A curling iron.
I'm told it's up at Crooks and Liars, and I'm going now to have a look.
Okay.
Shouldn't be too long here. Oh, wow, there's some more, there's some more revisionist history. We should have nominated this one for Moran Monday. Karen Hughes, Bush rescued the economy.
Rescued it from recovery, the depression?
I don't know. I just ran past the headline. Let's see. Brown supporters call Coakley supporters Nazis. They are a nice, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, a classy bunch, classy bunch. Come on, where? Oh, yeah, there it is. The IHOP campaign rally, shove a curling iron up her butt.
Yep.
That's just nice.
And he didn't tell them to stop saying stuff like it's one thing if people say stuff, but it's how the candidate reacts too. Like if somebody says something and then you say, no, we're not going to talk about violence or. You know.
Well, and on top
of the theater in the election or something like, but he let it go.
Well, and the irony of all of this, Cassie, is the context in which that hateful remark was made. Before it was said, he said, I'll tell you what. There's negative campaigning, and then there's malicious campaigning. And then the guy in the crowd, she's malicious! And then another one, she's a phony! Shove a curling iron up her butt! That doesn't even... That's... Wow.
Yeah.
And you know what? They note in the post at Crooks and Liars that it's hard to make out what he says, but it's very possible he responds to the curling iron comment by saying, we could do that.
No. Well, you know that's not playing on the mainstream media in Massachusetts.
And he smiled about the, you know, he smiled about it.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, you got to love some pig licking family values, don't you, Cassie?
Not me.
Yeah, me neither. Not so much.
Okay, so then my other question is about Haiti.
Yes.
So we've been talking about race, and you were talking to, I don't know which call, Kevin maybe? You were talking about how a lot of stuff in this country is about race. I think it was Kevin, and you said that...
Yeah, that was Kevin.
I couldn't believe it was all bigoted, and you said, but you know it is.
Right.
Right?
Right.
How much of the fact that Haiti is as poor as it is, and how much of the fact that the United States has tried to invade it and tried to do, you know, overthrow the leaders and then all of that stuff, how much of the problems that are there because the people who live there are dark? Like, would America have done the same thing if they had light skin? And would...
Ronald Reagan invaded Grenada over what? 48 American medical students. many of whom, most of whom, were white. Well, that you'll have, you probably, it was Ronnie's little Caribbean war. He was bored, and there were rumors that the Cubans were going to come into Grenada, and they was all going to become communists, and we had to save them medical students. So Ronald Reagan basically waged war on a tiny Caribbean island nation off the Venezuelan coast called Grenada. And then, well, we had to go in and save those medical students, most of whom were, of course, white. And there may have been 48 or 148, but you know, Grenada, we went into Grenada and shot a lot of people and killed some dark-skinned folks. And yeah. Now,
I've never heard of this.
Grenada. There's your homework for tonight.
Okay. I'll add it to my list. It seems like when I see stuff on the news, they're not even talking about what made Haiti so poor, and they're not talking about race at all.
Nope. Can't do it. We cannot have that conversation in this country.
It's Martin Luther King Day. If there's ever a day to have that conversation, isn't that today?
Yes, that is today. And it is, of all days, you're right, Cassie, it is the day that we should have that conversation. But we live in a political climate where if you try to suggest that the America has anything to do with why any other nations around it are so pathetically poor, you're just an America hater. You just want to blame America first. That's that blame America first crap. You know it. You hear that.
Yeah.
You know where. I mean, and I've recent on three or four occasions, and I'm pretty sure it was Porfirio Diaz in Mexico who said in Spanish that I can't speak, poor Mexico, so far from God, so near to the United States. And you can say that about Haiti, too. And you can say it about Cuba. And you can say it about, because you see, now while we haven't had a discussion of race in Haiti, and we haven't had a discussion of how Haiti got to be Haiti, we have had, in various places in the for-profit media, discussions of, well, you know, Haiti's had some bad government. They've had a lot of dictators down there. And that seems to be the...
Aren't we the one who overthrew the dictator before the dictator?
We came in and we rescued Jean-Bertrand Aristide when he started getting a little bit too uppity for George W. Bush's liking. But he was democratically elected.
Was he going to get killed? I mean, did we have to rescue him?
He didn't want to be rescued. He had to be rescued with a gun to his head.
That's not rescue.
Oh, but it was in Bushmerica. You know, so now he's living in exile in South Africa and posting things out saying, I want to come back and share in my country's experience. This man's a former Catholic priest and a practitioner of something called liberation theology that the church at Rome and Catholics and you know, the Catholic hierarchy in the United States hates, because it says that poor people have a right they have human rights co-equal to that of their wealthy betters.
Oh, that's almost like democracy. They don't like that.
Oh, it's practically communism. You know, during the Reagan administration, nuns and priests who were practitioners of liberation theology practically walked around with bullseyes on the backs of their heads in South and Central America. Because you can't take something like the church and use it as a force for good or anything. But what I was getting at is, you know, we say, well, Haiti sure has had a bunch of dictators. And that's the end of the question, Cassie. That's the end of the discussion. We don't ask the follow-up, which naturally is, why would that be? Well, the fact of the matter is, the United States of America has been very, very content. I think happy is a little too strong, but very much content, Cassie, to have dictators in Haiti doing God knows what to God knows whom for God knows why. We've been very content with that as long as the corporate interests that operate there have been able to do so with almost no oversight and certainly no interference from that dictatorial government. And that's the thing with dictators. They will most often get in bed with some business form or all business forms and take their kickbacks and make their bribes and personally loot the nation as Papa Doc and Baby Doc Duvalier did. And then and American corporations are happy. I mean, look at the Batista regime in Cuba. You know, Fidel Castro did not come to power in Cuba because he had a million-man army and just forced his way on the country. His was a little insurgency in the Cuban mountains that gained steam as it gained ground. Because the Cuban people saw him as a means to get out from under the corporate control and the filthy fascistic inclinations of the Batista regime that we propped up. See, we got Cuba.
And we propped up someone in Iran, right? Who was? Didn't we do the same thing in Iran?
Sure we did. It was 1952 and after. They had a democratically elected prime minister named Mohammad Mossadegh, and he got this uppity notion that he was going to nationalize the oil in Iran and keep it for the well-being and the good of the Iranian people. Well,
that's why we took him out.
The British oil interests said, oh, by Jove, we can't have this from that little brown bugger. And the CIA and Theodore Roosevelt, led by Theodore Roosevelt's grandson, fomented a coup it's just sickening to read the history of it, fomented a coup whereby the democratically elected government of Iran was overthrown, and Reza Pahlavi, who later became known as the Shah, was returned to the peacock throne. And he ruled Iran with an iron fist. He had a secret police that probably could have taught the Mossad a thing or two. It was called the Sadiq. And they didn't hesitate to torture, and they didn't hesitate to murder. And very few people know, Cassie, that when the Iranian Revolution came in the late 1970s, that at the same time, all we ever saw on American television were these jumping up and down men holding posters of Ayatollah Khomeini. We never saw them holding posters of Mohammad Mossadegh, but they were most assuredly there.
Well,
yeah,
okay.
We've got a history of this. We did it in Guatemala. We did it in Honduras. They just used a phrase in Argentina called the disappeared. Or maybe it was Chile, or maybe it was both. Yeah, oh, we propped up Augusto Pinochet in Chile. We have screwed up everything we have touched in the Western Hemisphere. Because we always go in under the guise of fighting communism. And in the process of doing so, what we're doing is propping up fascism. Because we, honest to God, it may prove to be the fatal flaw of American foreign policy, Cassie, that we go into countries and we don't care what the government there is doing to its own people as long as we're making the country safe for the for American corporations. You know, the reason that we got such a...
If corporations weren't considered people and corporations couldn't donate to political candidates, do you think that we would be better about this stuff?
There will always be companies and there will always be business interests, and as long as the political structure of the United States is such as it is, they will always wield a certain amount of influence. So to say that it's strictly structural, dependent upon the existence of corporations, is, I think, a little bit off base. But the bottom line is the failure to follow that good and fatherly advice that was tendered by George Washington upon his exodus from the White House. He said three words.
Avoid foreign entanglement.
There you go. Gold star for Cassie.
Okay, one more thing that I'm not seeing on the news, but I'm seeing in the blogs.
Mm-hmm.
And I know why, but when they're talking about that there's violence or that people are hurting, you know, people are, like, they're talking about people stealing and looting in Haiti, but what they're not talking about, and something that's happening a lot, is violence against girls and violence against women, and that men are hurting women in order to get, because the men are stronger, in order to get food for themselves. Have you seen any of this?
I've seen mention of some of it, but it certainly isn't getting broad play.
It's one of those things that's like, and this, you know, there's 10 minutes left in the show, but there is something way wrong with our TV networks and, well, mostly TV. I don't really look at a newspaper, but they're just focusing on the, like, if you look at MSNBC at 10 in the morning and then you look at MSNBC at 3 in the afternoon, it's exactly the same stories and exactly the same pictures over and over and over, and they don't have some of the, they don't focus on some of the other things that you only see on Facebook or Twitter or the lefty blogs. They're just missing it. They're missed it. Our media misses the point on everything. They're just so backwards.
They're not backwards. They don't, Cassie.
They're corporate.
They don't want to report that stuff.
Why?
Because it's easier not to.
But wouldn't more people watch it if?
No, more people. It's been. No, the bean counters have proven time and again that more people will watch if you have more stories about missing white girls and black golfers who have multiple affairs with blonde women. Yeah, I realize it may take you.
America that's wrong.
Yes, America is wrong about this. But America has also been.
The media should do their job anyway. Like even
a. Oh, and by the way, the story on the Shah, I'm being reminded by Ron in Raleigh because I read this book and it's brilliant. The book you want to get hold of if you want to understand the coup that we fomented in Iran is called Overthrow.
Okay.
And it's by Stephen Kinzer, and it's the definitive work on it. But no, to get at what you're talking about, the American people have been conditioned to want this, okay? The most viral thing on the interweb tubes in America right now is a thing from American Idol called Pants on the Ground.
Yeah, I've seen it.
See? So have I. And if I've seen it, you know it's gotten around.
It's everywhere.
Okay.
But it's only a minute. I mean, you can watch real stuff too.
Right, but it's only a minute, and that's a minute that America doesn't have for doing the very deep introspective work that America desperately needs to do. Because this isn't, you know, what's happening in Haiti is not just oh poor Haiti, look what's happening in Haiti. What's happening in Haiti happened in New Orleans.
Yeah, and it was black people there, too.
Yeah, remember the photos? The black folk carrying food above the water, over their head above the water? They were looting.
And writing out, help me, on their roof with whatever they had.
Yeah, but on the other hand, there was another AP photograph of white people carrying food over their heads wading through the water, and they were foraging for survival. Black people loot, white people forage for survival.
Then they need more black editors.
Maybe. Maybe.
Fair editors.
Or maybe we need more people with journalistic ethics. But see, something happens. I mean, there's plenty of real journalism being done out there. You're doing some of it. Matt Osborne over at Osborne Inc. is doing it. Mike Stark that he mentioned, Mike is doing it. They do all kinds of journalism over at Crooks and Liars. Some of the best opinion out there happens at BartCop.com. It's getting done. But the thing is, when you get up into that atmosphere where you get to talk to millions of people at a time, and you are paid accordingly, then suddenly your willingness to step over the line is severely compromised. Because you do not, it does, never mind your journalistic credentials, you don't want to put at hazard your paycheck.
Do you think Rachel Maddow has compromised herself?
I'm going to answer that, Cassie, and I'm going to answer it as candidly as I can, and I mean no insult to Rachel, because I respect her immensely. I don't think she has consciously. But she has the position, and she has the paycheck, and even if she doesn't do it consciously, it is almost impossible not to do subconsciously. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think so.
You self-censor.
Right.
You know, I mean, I self-censor. I mean, I'll sit, and it's not money-related, it's feelings-related, but I got an email once upon a time from someone who said, because I use that line, crazier than a sprayed roach, right? Well, there was another one that I used to use that was a little more graphic and a little bit further up the evolutionary scale. And I got an email from a listener one night who said, Bob, I wish you wouldn't use that. Every time you use that phrase, it hurts me. And I have self-censored ever since. Even though it was just a funny little throwaway line, I quit using it because it was being, and I self-censored because I don't want to hurt anybody. I remember once upon a time, I jokingly referred to, back when Agnes was producing this program, Cassie, I jokingly referred to, well, you know, I've got to hit the brake or else Agnes will hit me with an iron skillet.
And I got upset.
And you got upset.
I did.
And I quit saying that. So I only say it now when I see that you're not in the chat room.
Well, you can say it now.
No, but you understand the point.
Yes.
Self-censorship is something that we do as a matter of course. But the more money that is on the line, the more profound and perhaps the more subliminal becomes the self-censorship. I mean, here's a good experiment. Two people that are respectable. Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow.
Yeah.
Maddow. Not Maddow. Maddow. Rhymes with shadow. Dave Letterman said that. Rachel Maddow. Keith Olbermann. Keep a log. For a week. Who advertises on the network availabilities in their program? Now, having done that, continue to watch and see if they ever criticize anything in that field.
Oh, do they say anything about the medication producers?
Not so much.
Like that kind of thing?
Right, exactly. For instance, if you are sponsored by Archer Daniels Midland, how many shows are you going to produce about the negative effects of corporate welfare on agriculture policy? Here's the answer, none. And that's why Archer Daniels Midland used to sponsor, and may still, all kinds of Sunday news programs.
So that they wouldn't talk about corporate agriculture.
Yeah, or Frankenfoods, or Frankenseed, or genetically modified nightmares, or any of that stuff. No, There's that's buying access.
That's why they advertise there?
Huh?
That's why they advertise there?
Sure. I mean, you can't go to the grocery store and buy anything from Archer Daniels Midland. They don't have any products.
They're not Archer cookies?
No. That's Archway.
No, we have Archer.
No, it's not them.
Okay.
Let's see. There used to be another, I can't remember it. It started with a B, three initials. And their slogan was, we don't make the things, we don't make the things we use. We don't make the things you use. We make the things you use better. You can't buy anything by them. Why are they advertising? They're advertising because those Sunday morning TV programs are watched by what, Crooks and Liars refers to as the villagers. And they can thereby manipulate the message that the villagers receive. A little creepy.
That's evil.
Yes, it is. And the first rule to dealing with the evil is to know that the evil exists, Cassie. It's a shame that, BSF. We don't make the things you use. We make the things you use better. In other words, they made additives for paint, and they were a huge corporate toxic polluter.
So they weren't making it better. They were just making it
more profitable.
Proof.
More profitable, maybe.
And editorial proof.
Yeah, there you go.
Do newspapers work the same way?
Sure. Sure. Just read your local newspaper. See how much advertising comes from what department store. And then see if you don't wind up, watch the business section and see if there isn't a favorable business story about something relating to one of the advertisers. Sleazy as heck. That's why the corporate advertising model can no longer work in the print journalism world. But Cassie, I've run over, dear.
Okay.
Yeah, BASF. That was BASF. See, I knew I'd figure it out sooner. Yeah. Cobwebs figured that. BASF. That was the company. And that's it. Thanks, Cassie. Have a wonderful evening.
You too. Thanks.
All right. Take care. Bye now.
Bye.
Cassie calling from Texas. Wow. What a show. No breaks, no nothing. 3 solid hours of conversation radio. Tell me where else you can find that. Hint, you can't. We are at the end of the program. It is the 18th of January. I hate doing this in the midst of the crisis, but you know what? I got to, because we won't even talk about it if we ain't here. We are past halfway through January. We are not halfway to the fundraising that we need to do to keep the horn on the air. The PayPal button works nicely, as does the snail mail address at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. If you can, please help. That's all I'll say. Thanks to everyone who makes this show such a joy to do, from Lottie and ELO in the chat room to John Fox, Peter Godbold, and Ben Birch. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org, the hardest working, bravest people I know. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
show. Head on with Boz Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! If it's Monday, then it must be Peoria. No, wait, Bob, wait, that's from the old summer stock days. No, if it's Monday, there must be Morans. Oh, yes, brethren and sister, no, wait, that's Wednesday. It's Moran Monday on the horn! Whoop! And we have several contestants for you this evening. Oh, don't we? I've had this one on my list for, several days now, ever since the news broke. Maybe the news broke Friday, I'm not sure. But, you know, you can qualify for Moran Monday anytime, not you, you know what I mean. A right-wing Republican, more likely than not, evangelical, fundamentalist, authoritarian, proto-fascist, whatever, can qualify for Moran Monday any time between the end of show Friday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and showtime Monday, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That is almost a complete Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That is almost a complete 72-hour window. It is, in fact, and the pervs among you will appreciate this, a 69-hour window in which the Morans can always, always, always have a shot at making the Moran Monday list here on the horn. And they certainly did work at it this weekend, I have to tell you. I put together the show post to send off to News Ninja Susan because she knows how to drive the blog and I don't. I drive it into buggies and parking lots and stuff when I try to drive the blog. But News Ninja Susan knows how. And I'm going to learn soon. I keep promising myself. I really, really am. I keep trying, but I don't do it enough to make it sort of burn itself into my tiny little mind. But anyway, no, I just sent the show post off to News Ninja Susan, and I put what I thought were some solid nominees in. You're welcome to nominate on your own if you so desire. But here, let me just lay out, and by the way, something else, something serious that we have for this evening. We will be joined by American World Service Corps promoter and the peace activist, I think, is a safe word to use. Dwayne Hunn, here in about, 27 minutes or so, for a little talk about Haiti and how something like an American World Service Corps could have made the response to Haiti a great deal more fluid and a great deal more effective. So that's coming up in about 27 minutes. But before we get there, we do have our Moran nominees. One of them, I have to tell you, is visual. So, on my status update over at Facebook, you can find the link. It is a YouTube link that was provided to me by, Garrett, whom you've heard on the program on a number of occasions, who comes from out Vegas way and is a dedicated sport fan. As well as, he's a polymath of many subjects, like so many folks here on the horn. I'm blessed with smart people and not ditto heads, and believe me, that's what's made this doable for so long. But anyway, I've got this. I posted, and I included the link also in the show post to Susan, so it'll be there on the
porn website as well, headonradionetwork.com, okay? What you'll see, well, let me see if I can combine these two. First of all, my first nominee, because it happened, like I said, very near the beginning of the end of the Friday night show in the more